Good evening, brothers and sisters of the Leaf. Coming to you live from the upstairs balcony of O'Brien's Irish Pub in historic downtown Temple, Texas, it's the Tuesday Night Cigar Club Podcast. Tonight, the boys take in a screening of 1986's Nomads while sampling the Nomad Connecticut Fuerte cigar from Nomad Cigar Company in House of Emilio, paired with some straight-up lager-licious pints of Carbach Brewery's Sympathy for the Lager beer. Sounds like our crew is going to rock this show harder and sexier than Tawny Catane in a Whitesnake video. So sit back, light them up, and enjoy the show.
In the words of the iconic Adam Ant, you don't drink, you don't smoke, what do you do? Now I'm asking you guys, if you don't drink and don't smoke, what do you do?
Do people do something other?
Do you do crossword puzzles? Do you scrapbook?
I'm at a loss.
I don't.
Volunteer at a soup kitchen. What do people do that don't drink and don't smoke?
Frozen sing-alongs.
Sadly, you're right. I think there's a weird subset of society that engages in this nefarious activity. But from the looks of you two putzes, I'm asking this question to the wrong audience. Welcome to the Tuesday Night Cigar Club Podcast. I'm your host, Matt A. Cade. With me, as always, is putz number one, Cody Leshker, putz number two, Jason Tuttle. I bring up Adam Ant because he's an interesting figure in our film we'll be watching tonight. And honestly, I've had music on my mind a little bit lately, and thought it kind of bring it to the forefront. Greetings, as always, from the upstairs balcony of O'Brien's Irish Pub in downtown Temple, Texas. I'm sitting at the table with two guys who love 80s music more than maybe any other two guys I know. Maybe different styles of 80s music,
like,
but
music.
I'm not saying you don't like all music, but you guys are unapologetic 80s music fans.
Child of the 80s.
I mean, Tuttle, you're sitting here in front of me in a brand new, crisp Steve Miller Band t-shirt.
But that was 60s, late 60s and 70s as well.
Was Abracadabra not in the 80s?
I think Abracadabra, if it wasn't 80s, it was late 70s.
Okay.
But it just sounds 80s.
But you saw them open up for Journey.
That's right.
2 weeks ago.
That's
and
right.
You had a blast.
I had a wonderful time. The only disappointing part was it was a rescheduled show, and Tower of Power was supposed to be the opener. Loved Tower of Power, so I was really kind of excited to see them. But like I said, their show got canceled the first go around, and when they rescheduled it, Tower of Power couldn't go. But it was Steve Miller Band and Journey, and it was a wonderful show.
When I bring this up, and Cody, I know you're a live music fan, and in conjunction with that, as one of the owners of O'Brien's Irish Pub, you have live music here, you know, a minimum of four nights a week.
Yes.
So your life, a big part of your life is listening to live music.
It is.
Whether you like it or not, you listen to a lot of it.
That's very true.
Tuttle, you go to a lot of live shows.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of want to throw this out there just before we get started, just because it was on my mind, and well, what the hell not? I can do what I want. I passed up the opportunity today. My favorite band of all time is Faith No More.
Good band.
They left us in the late 90s with their last album and disappeared, which by all counts was for good. They all went off and did their own separate things. I continued to follow their singer, Mike Patton, through a million other projects, but the idea of a Faith No More reunion was never... I never got a chance to see them live in their heyday. And then all of a sudden, they started playing some reunion shows a few years ago. And it was just kind of summed up. That was it. Just a few reunion shows. They're releasing a new album in May. Brand new album. New material. They did the right thing as far as some of these other you know, bands that get back together. They just kind of go out and rehash the same stuff over and over. They'd had enough of that, and they're like, if we're going to keep doing this, we need to record some new stuff. And they have a brand new album coming out in May, which I'm totally over the moon about. It's called Soul of Invictus. But today, I found out yesterday that they're finally coming to Texas in July. Tickets went on sale this morning at 10 o'clock, and I literally stayed up all night debating whether I was going to get tickets. Number one, the venue in Austin, which is our nearest city to where we're at, is the Austin Music Hall, where Cody and I went and saw Tenacious. Well, we went there with the intent to see Tenacious D.
I heard Tenacious D music.
A few years ago.
Yeah. I didn't actually see Tenacious
D. We didn't actually see them. It's a horrible venue. We left. I think my wife and I left about three songs in. I think you guys left pretty quick after that.
Yeah, it was...
Where we were kind of sequestered on the side. Granted, we got there sort of late, but...
Yeah.
The stage setup, we couldn't even see Jack Black. It was basically, we were looking at a KG solo show, which, you know, nothing against KG, but... between that and the UT frat kid spilling his cocaine on me, standing next to me, and I just kind of realized last night, I was like, you know, as much as I want to see Faith No More, I think I'm getting old to the point to where the idea of standing up and watching a band for 2 hours, I can't do it. Traffic, parking, and then, you know, if there were seats, and I realized
there were seats and bar service,
and I realized, holy shit, man, you're old. I can't believe. So this morning at 10 o'clock, when those tickets went on sale, I had to like, hey, this is my one chance in the world to see my favorite band of all time, because they probably won't do this again.
Yeah.
Or you have to just fess up to, like, you know what? You're not a fan of live music, and even your favorite band, you're not willing to go through the hoops and the stuff. And I didn't get tickets.
What?
And it's been weighing on me all day. But
to quote Rodney Dangerfield from the great movie Back to School, do not go gently into that good night. No, you go see it. Pull up a laptop right now and get tickets.
No, it's too late.
But what you were saying about the Austin Music Hall is spot on.
It's a horrible venue.
If you get there late and you have to, and you're up top, it sucks so bad. There's no really good place if you're having to stand up off. Now, if you get there early enough and you can fight the crowd and get up to that rail, it's an okay spot. Other than that, I've only been to one concert there, and I really don't want to go back.
Well, it was miserable. It was completely money down the toilet, and you know what? I'm leaning towards I don't need to see them. I also have that other feeling, like, and I think there's an old Seinfeld episode where Elaine asked Jerry about going to see a concert, and a guy, and he's like, why do I need to stand there and watch a guy sing? Like, what? Because the wife didn't want to go with me because she had a horrible experience at the venue.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what am I going to stand there? And I'm like, what do you do when you're watching a band? You know, do you move to the music? Do you give him a thing? Do you yell? Like, I just think it's an awkward experience. Much more so the older you get, and I think I'm kind of done with it.
I am not, but it has to be for the right. It has to be for the right deal. If I'm going to stand up the entire deal, it has to be the right kind of venue with the right kind of crowd.
And I say that's ultimately that is the actual experience. Is the venue. You can go and see, I mean, what we like to do is, I mean, for us, we're a small place. The bands that play here, we do it for, so that, you know, the musician and the crowd has good interaction.
Yeah.
So that
Which they do, you know, and
a lot of places, they separate the two. Obviously, you know, they're trying to keep, you know, control a large crowd. But it's, and the venue itself, if it's not designed for live music... Austin Music Hall was, I think it honestly was an afterthought. It decided to become a live music venue.
I think it moved. I think it used to be something else.
And then they renovated it.
That's fancy lighting stuff working.
It's just not, I mean, they didn't, it's poorly designed for live
music. It really is. And so anyway, we had this Adamant factor, and it was on my mind, so I thought I'd bring it up because I don't know. It's always good to inject a little other things that are on your heads, but... I threw that out there. What I do like about watching live music at O'Brien's is you have the option. You've got, especially on big bands, you've got the option to stand there and get right up close and personal, or you can sit up on the balcony, enjoy your drink, and you know, just take it easy.
Yeah.
And
ultimately, that's what I
like
about
those
O'Brien's
options,
is that you're not 10 foot off that stage.
And I just don't think I got it in me anymore. So... If Faith No More doesn't get me to jump in, I don't know who
could. I will not I will not go gently into that good night.
Well, God bless you.
Rage,
I mean,
against the dying of the light.
Well, you raged a lot last year at the Pet Shop Boys concert at
Depeche
Mode. The Cure, Depeche Mode. You covered a lot of 80s bands last year.
It was the year of synth pop. My wife is a huge synth pop fan. I actually got a little bit of an appreciation because I never really listened to them that much in the 80s.
Yeah.
But coming off of that Depeche Mode Cure deal, and even Pet Shop Boys, they put on a fun show. It's not really my cup of tea, but still a fun show.
Well, you balanced it. I know you saw Black Sabbath and some other... You balanced it with some you know, testosterone.
Yeah, but nothing can absolve from the Morrissey show. That was just...
You were in a funk for a good while after Morrissey, which... You know, who could blame you?
Probably so.
If you do
think about it now, and I'm tearing up.
I saw 15 minutes worth of slaughtered animal video. That was fun.
I landed on this note, on a high note. If you do get a chance, if you're in the Central Texas area, once a year, Reverend Horton Heat comes through O'Brien's. And it's usually an outdoor show. This year was the first indoor show.
It was the beginning of the year. We didn't... Unsure of the weather, and temperature, that sort of thing.
It's nuts.
I love indoor shows.
It is nuts. And that's a live experience that I can... I felt bad missing it this year, but something like that is when, you know... Well, usually the brothers put me to work maintaining the integrity and the safety of the band and the stage.
You solved that one all by yourself.
Yeah, I solved that problem all myself. I let some chick run up on stage and... stage dive, and she was a gazelle, damn it, she was a gazelle, she was so fast and wiry, but they haven't asked me to do that since. Alright, well, enough about me. It's a nice little tangent to get things started as we light our cigars. The only real thing before we get started I want to say is we are going to start doing some solo reviews on the website when we're at home or out and about.
Yeah, just whenever we feel like it.
We try a new cigar. We're going to have a new section on the website where we can all post, you know, a pic and our, you know, our thoughts on it. Nothing fancy, but just we figured, you know what, we smoke a lot of stuff outside of the Tuesday Night Club. And so why not just give everybody access to go on there and, you know, snap a dick pic and... We'll be posting our dick pics on the...
You've been reading that Snowden article.
Up on the website, and I did read that Snowden article. You know, I've been trying now for like 2 months to get Mincy to stop sending me dick pics, and I've just ruined it because I'm promoting it. No dick pics. We're going to be snapping pics of our cigars and what we're smoking, what we think about it, and... you know, just a quick little thing, yay or nay, and or if we go to a cigar bar if we're traveling... Just kind of a new little section of the website to kind of chronicle that stuff, so that'll be cool. Last week's show, we with Mr. Mincy, who's not here tonight, we went way back to the great cinematic year of 1986 for Stephen King's Maximum Overdrive. And that film was so warmly received by the group, I decided to go right back to the well for tonight's movie.
Went down even deeper.
Oh, geez, 1986. I promise, We're done with that for a while.
Or are we?
No, we are. So hopefully we'll have better results tonight. We're also going back tonight to get things started on the cigar to the House of Emilio umbrella brands. Last week we reviewed the very impressive Emilio AF1 Maduro-wrapped cigar. We were all pretty impressed.
Yeah, I looked up on Atlantic Cigar. They're sold out.
I think Cigar Federation had some.
Did they?
There was a question in the show last week about the price point. It was six online.
Yeah, right about
six, which is amazing.
Atlantic had, I think, right at $558.
Yeah. I mean, for that, for anything that you mentioned, Liga Privada as a comparison point, and with that kind of construction and smoke production and burn line and just really solid, bold, earthy flavors, under $6, I mean, how can you go wrong?
Yeah. So,
That was a pleasure last week. We all really dug it. And we're going to sample something from the House of Emilio on the other side of the spectrum tonight, which I'll go ahead and introduce. It is the Nomad Connecticut Fuerte. The Nomad Cigar Company, which is distributed by House of Emilio also, bills this as not your father's Connecticut cigar. It promises a flavor profile that they worked really hard on to take you, grab you, and take notice of it compared to the more mild Connecticut cigars out there. And we just lit up, but I got to tell you, the idea of a Connecticut cigar with kind of a, you know, ballsy attitude, shoving other cigars around the humidor, just, you know, taking center stage and saying, notice me. I like the idea. I like the idea of playing with the Connecticut. It's kind of the, you know, the wimp of the cigar world as far as strength.
I know a lot of people that love them.
Wimp not equating to unpopular.
Yeah.
I'm just saying it's, you know.
In terms of strength.
In terms of strength of it, it's definitely on the left side of the strength meter. And so I'm curious to see what they're going to do. It should be interesting. Quick background, it's manufactured in the Dominican Republic. Ecuadorian Connecticut wrapper, I believe Ecuadorian Habano binder, and Dominican and Nicaraguan filler tobacco.
Kind of all over the place.
These were submitted to us by Gary Griffith of House of Emilio. Throw that out there. We're very appreciative. But like last week, we'll give it our honest go around here because we don't know any other way.
Do you have an address for Emilio?
I believe it's houseofemilio.com.
Cool.
But they are distributing a lot of different brands under a lot of different blenders, and so I'm pumped. It's a beautiful looking cigar. It's a little bit darker shade Connecticut than it's you know, kind of a medium brown. Very vascular.
Incredibly.
Like
a lot of veins.
Like me.
Like Cody mentioned about me when we did the Expendables stuff, how I kept getting more vascular. So far, the initial
polls for me has got a little bit of strength for Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
but very smooth. And I'm curious to... I'm going to try to slow down this week.
I'm not. I'm going to chain smoke all the way through this.
I can see it already. But when I gave Cody the 411 on what we were smoking tonight and kind of what they were going for it, I turned him loose on the O'Brien's tap wall. And what'd you find for us tonight?
This is the Carbach Brewery's Sympathy for the Lager, following in the theme of nomads, and it's kind of goes down that whole, you know, sympathy for the devil.
Pleased to meet you. Let me introduce myself.
Oh God,
I'm a beer. Wealth and taste.
Are you doing the Axl Rose Sympathy for the Devil?
I have no idea what I'm doing.
What that was.
So Carbach,
who we love. Houston's own Carbach Brewery.
Correct. We've had one of theirs before. They're vice versa.
Vice versa.
This is their lager, Sympathy for the Lager. It's lager has kind of become the, not the bastard child in terms of like craft beer. Lager's always been out there. It's what the major breweries have been carrying forever, and we basically just, you know, they turned it into light beer. I mean, it's,
yeah.
So lager is kind of a generic term for beer.
Yeah.
In its own way, yes.
The majority of just the domestic beer you get is technically a lager.
And that, and when you're trying to, as an entrepreneur, when you're trying to enter a marketplace, the last thing you want to do is develop something that's kind of like your main competition. So the first thing that they want to try to do is get as far away from the main guys as possible.
A lot of them have done that, and I should say the majority of the craft have done that. Some have realized lager's a strong beer. It stands on its own. It's been around forever. Most people can pick one up and tell you it's a lager. I can sit there. I can enjoy it. It's a lot of people, you know, a lot of the craft ones, they've supposed to going back to like lager for a, you know, a lighter beer in comparison to some of the darker ales. They've gone to using like a blonde ale, you know, and I think that's still a hindrance. You're still drinking an ale. It might be the lighter of the ales, but you know, lager has its place. It's good. It's solid. I will always drink a lager.
Yeah, it's good, tasty, especially in the summertime when the temperature heats up.
It does. It's kind of got that. At least this does. No, it's kind of like a maltiness. Lager, you can kind of taste the malts.
Oh yes,
a little sweetness to it.
Very sweet.
Well, growing up in a time before the craft industry really kind of boomed out there, this is what I would have said beer tastes like.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
It tastes like beer lager.
And in Carbach, use this one. They have, I mean, pretty much all the hops in here are German hops, noble hops. They're used several types of malts. Vienna.
Pretty much all German.
Yeah, they've tried to recreate that because it's.
Now, when you threw this at me, I looked it up, Mr. Leshiker, that this was an homage to Czech beers. is that the, you know, what is a characteristic of a Czech beer as far as what were they trying to? Yeah, this is an homage to it. What were they? When you think Czech beer, what are your? Is it crisp? Is it a? Is there bold strength to it? Like, when you think Czech beer, what do you think of?
When I think Czech beer, I really think of Pilsner. That was the original style that came from that area. Pils, the actual town where Pilsner was reportedly to come from originally. So that, when I think of Czech beer, or I think of, you know, beer as we know it today, That's what I think of. Okay. That's where I would go first.
Okay. So a heavy influence on the beer market. Yes.
That area right there between it, which is, it's very close to the German border. Mm-hmm. And within those two areas, within Germany and Czech Republic now, that is sort of the birthplace of the modern, of I say modern, within the last few hundred years, beer.
Right.
Yeah. Were there Czech monks?
Perhaps. I don't know if exactly what they were.
They were guys sleeping around the church, but they may have just been sleepy guys.
Okay.
Now, what is I read a little bit. There was some flotation process they do with this to give it a real light bit. Something to do with the bitterness, I guess, to keep the bitterness low.
Some, yes. This one, it's For the stats on this one, it's about 4.9%.
Oh, which is almost ABV, nothing. Huh?
And it's got 45 IBUs.
That's a little bit more than Guinness.
So it's actually, I would probably say, kind of a little high for a lager. A lot of them try to keep the IBUs low.
Yeah.
I mean,
so by maybe raising the bitterness a little bit, you make it interesting.
You give it a little bit more flavor.
You give it a little bit more of a,
but that's also indicative of the hops used. The German hops are, I would say, they have a little more kick to them.
Mm-hmm. A little feistier.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. The first few sips, it's really good.
Yeah.
Like I said, I from what little I know, I definitely get like a maltiness and kind of a sweetness there that I don't think we've really had in too many of the beers that we've.
That it's good because usually when you get into the sweetness of the stuff that we've covered so far, that comes from the citrus.
Citrus.
Yeah, there's no citrus stuff whatsoever. There's not. No, this is traditional good beer.
I do get a sweetness from it.
Citrus sweetness, or I don't get any citrus in this. I like with the torpedo and last week's. And last
week, I would get an. I say you get citrus out of its aroma,
and the vice versa. I definitely got the sweetness from the banana.
Yeah, I just taste crisp, clean beer. Mm. I love it.
I think we've got a good matchup going here with the cigar because the Noban so far is a very crisp, but much stronger than usual Connecticut. Like I'm getting a little bit more power in this than I do most. Granted, I'm not a huge Connecticut smoker. Cody smokes more Connecticut than any of us.
Definitely right in my wheelhouse.
Yeah, I figured you'd love it. The burn line is,
yeah, it's burning
construction wise beautiful. What are you feeling over there?
I'm going to reserve judgment on it. Mm-hmm. First light, it tastes like a Connecticut. It's got a little bit more strength to it.
That's where I'm at, but it's pleasant. I'm liking it.
Yeah, it's not. It doesn't have a lot. I don't know. It doesn't have a bitterness of that, of a like a mid-tier smoke.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just by that, the construction, you're automatically putting it a step above that. But in terms of taste profile, yeah, you're right in the Connecticut wheelhouse. It's got a little bit more of a strength to it, a little bit more of a taste, but very similar to Connecticut's. I will say that if you like Connecticut's, you're probably going to be happy with this. That's why Cody is like, this is in his wheelhouse.
I'm getting a strong woodsy kind of feeling that maybe a little bit stronger than most. We'll see how it goes. We're just getting started.
Now, what I do like is that as the Texas weather heats up, you got the Connecticut Leaf with the Carbach there, the Sympathy, and it's a very light, entertaining smoke.
We'll see as a light, new homeowner. We mentioned this before. You're a new homeowner. We'll see how you feel about the Connecticuts.
Come August
when you're doing lawn work, you may not be so inclined to reach for the dark, oily Nicaraguan at 4 in the afternoon when it's 120 balls outside. Connecticut's can be pretty good in the Texas summer.
You're totally right. You're totally
so,
right.
So keep an open mind. Trust me. Let's keep an eye on these guys. Our movie tonight, coincidentally, is Nomads. 1986, like I said. I've neglected to do this, and I said I would do it. I want to do cigars that everyone can go get, whether it's online or at your local brick and mortar. And I also want to do films that you can watch. Yeah. And I've been neglecting. I keep telling myself to shout out where we watch these things. Nomads is on Amazon Prime. If you're a Prime member, you can watch it, stream it for free. If not, it's like $2. But that's
very affordable.
Is that where we all watch it on Amazon?
Yes.
Okay.
We.
This movie has been on my radar for a long time. I've never seen it, but I wanted to. It is director John McTiernan's first film.
And he is?
He is one of my favorite directors. Not necessarily for... I wouldn't call him an auteur, where you watch a movie and you're like, oh, that's John McTiernan.
Yeah.
He's just done a lot of my favorite movies. So there's something there. Something that I definitely kept my eyes open on this, his first film, to see if there were glimpses of what we get. John McTiernan, after Nomads, this movie is the job that got him Predator.
No.
Arnold watched Nomads.
I was kind of wondering. I was like, where did this come from?
Arnold watched Nomads.
I was like, well, put this bug in your bonnet.
I think a producer brought it to him and said, do you think this guy can handle suspense and tension? And he did this on a very low budget. And this job got him Predator, which then got him Die Hard, which then got him Hunt for Red October, which then got him, yada yada. Well, Hunt for Red October, there's a few ones we'll overlook. Medicine Man.
I liked Medicine Man.
The Rollerball, you would.
I liked Rollerball.
Rollerball remake.
Oh, not the remake.
No, Rollerball, not with James Caan.
Yeah. I didn't see, I don't, I'm,
the LL wait, Cool J.
The LL Cool J? Yeah, okay, maybe I did see that.
Those were his two I saw. You know, he hadn't done a lot of films. He also did Die Hard 3, which was great, Die Hard with a Vengeance. He went back to that. And then he also did one of my most underrated movies, overlooked movies of all time, Last Action Hero.
Oh.
Love
it.
This movie, Nomad, started it all, and I'm excited to talk about it tonight. It's also the only film he ever wrote, which I'm glad.
Yeah, I saw that in the
which
credits,
I'm glad. I don't think that's his strength. I think he's a much stronger director than writer. But I wouldn't say it was there's a lot worse first features written.
Yeah.
It didn't fall in. Even last week, Maximum Overdrive, written by Stephen King of all people, this movie didn't fall into a lot of first time filmmaker
traps
that that movie
yeah.
did. It was a pretty sophisticated, pretty mature screenplay. Yeah.
I didn't know that this was his first directing effort and his first writing effort. So that kind of surprises me a little bit. I mean, there were some down parts to where I'm like, I would question with it. But
sure.
When you say that that's a first-time director, first-time writer, that's pretty strong effort.
And I'll tell you, as a filmmaker, there's nothing more embarrassing than your first time out there because it sucks. And you can only hope that there's enough glimpses of promise in there that somebody will recognize that.
Yeah, but I think what really helped is that he, besides directing it, he wrote it. He knew what he was looking for.
Yeah.
When it came time to shoot. And, just from, as I was watching it, I could definitely tell the camera work between all of those other movies. You could see a lot of those elements.
Yeah. And I'm going to get in.
And that's what worked, is that those same elements, they recur, but they're good for that.
And he brought them back, and I kept looking for it. I was like, all right, because especially in the early goings-ons, was a very straight-shot movie. But then I started to see little things that reminded me
as the action starts picking up later on. Camera work gets a little more sophisticated.
Oh, holy shit. Like, you see this, you see his meager budget and his first film instincts, wanting to do things, and he didn't quite get to push through. But then you're like, you know what? He totally burst that wall with Predator, or he totally did this scene on steroids with Die Hard.
Yeah.
So I'm going to point those out as we go along.
Yeah, that was a nice. Well, I'll talk about it. We'll get there.
But yeah, and he also did the 13th Warrior, which
one of my all time favorites.
Which Tuttle has been building up. I feel bad. No,
you get Predator and 13th Warrior.
I love 13th
love
Warrior.
It.
I feel bad that I'm saying I need to see it. There's no reason why I haven't.
If you like Predator, you'll like it.
So that's on my radar too, especially after seeing this, because I think that'll be I've seen everything. And so we open up with a really kind of surreal opening credit with this still photograph on this Alaskan fisherman, Eskimo fisherman. We kind of slowly zoom in on this photograph. It's blacked out; you can't see his face. Very spooky, very M. Night Shyamalan kind of imagery. And then we go to these kind of generic city shots of Los Angeles set to this 80s kind of synthesizer score. Bill Conti did the score for this, who is best known and has lived pretty much his whole life fat collecting checks for writing the Rocky theme music. and he also did Gonna Fly Now, the Rocky song.
I was kind of surprised that it was a little Carpenter-esque in the music.
At the beginning there was, and I was like, oh, Bill Conti, like, it's the Rocky guy. He doesn't really do much like this, and he didn't do anything other like this.
Yeah.
It reminded me kind of like Michael Mann, like a Miami Vice kind of Manhunter opening scene over... Los Angeles plays a big key part in this film.
Yeah.
So they set it up real nice, and then immediately we meet our female protagonist, Dr. Flax. A beautiful female doctor in the emergency room at LA's hospital, and she quickly encounters she's working the night shift, and she encounters this bloody, restrained, with handcuffs to his hospital bed, heavily bearded Pierce Brosnan, just talking this unintelligible French dialogue. Thrashing, and nobody can get this guy to calm down. And she finally, she sends everybody out of the room, and she starts whispering to him. She's gonna calm down. And before you know it, he rips out of his shackles and reaches up and whispers in her ear, and boom, he's dead. So this is Pierce Brosnan's first film, his first screen credit. Not counting Remington Steele.
Okay.
This was his first lead in the film.
I was wondering whether Remington Steele was first and then this, or whether this was...
Remington Steele was first. This was his first on movie lead.
So basically you're coming from... And the reason why I was saying that was because my business partner and I were talking about the choice of the French accent with Pierce Brosnan. Because that took a little bit for me to get used to. Pierce Brosnan's in Remington Steele, and he is Bond, and all of a sudden he's talking with the French accent. And we were trying to figure out what that choice was, and I told him, I was like, if it followed Remington Steele, which popularized Brosnan, then what's the first thing that most actors try to do to avoid being typecast? They go opposite
they
of
go
what,
something
the,
different,
what the British
which
do.
Which means a beard,
cover
up that beautiful face. Yeah. And do an accent.
But the end scene brought it right back to Remington.
Let's not go there. So he dies, which is weird.
Off the bat.
He's second build character, and all of a sudden he is dead. Flatline, they declare him dead.
Yeah.
And you do not hear what he whispered into Dr. Flax's ear. We'd learn his name is Jean-Charles.
Gene? Oh, I mean Jean. Of course it's Gene.
Is it Jean or Jean? Or Jean?
You don't call it Jean-Luc Picard.
Jean-Claude Van Damme.
You don't call it Jean-Claude Van Damme. It's Jean.
I said Jean.
Yeah.
You corrected me.
I said
Jean.
Being smug.
Oh. Much like Jean-Claude. Smug bastard. His little tight little pants and his kicks. Makes me so mad.
He's earned it, though.
Eh. I still think he's the most overrated action star in history. Right?
I can kind of agree with that, yeah.
Body of work, quality of movies, he stinks.
Yeah, I'd rather see the dude from Kung Pao Chicken.
Oh, that guy was funny.
Now, I will say...
it wasn't called Kung Pao Chicken, was it? Kung Pao, I don't know.
Yeah, Enter the Fist.
Enter the Fist. Like that.
Yeah. And now, I will say with Jean-Claude, I do like his older stuff, like his recent stuff, the B-movie stuff. When he can't really take himself too serious, I like that part.
I've never been a fan of Jean-Claude. I think I said this in our Expendables episode. Like, I thought he just walked through Expendables 2.
That's true.
I didn't really...
He did. I mean, why would he need to even bother doing
anything? Because Jean-Claude, he hadn't done anything in years.
That's not true.
This is your chance.
No, he hadn't done anything that was like that big. Everything else was direct to video.
I don't know.
And he's done just movie after movie direct, you know.
I am a Seagal guy.
Go check out Seagal. Go check out Netflix. Go check out any of the online stuff. Man, he just got title after title. He's been constantly working. I'll give him that.
Well, let's call him for the sake of the show, since none of us numbnuts know how to pronounce anything. Let's say Jean-Charles.
Jean-Charles.
That's what I've been practicing all day. So
all right.
Jean-Charles.
You're doing well.
Jean-Charles.
Jean-Charles.
Three.
Quattro.
You did four.
There's
only three of us.
Oh. Sank.
Maybe he's getting two for himself.
Give me two. Okay. So... she encounters him, he whispers in her ear, and then he dies. I will say as a side note here, I don't know if you guys caught this, while she's being stitched up, because I guess he cut her with...
Yeah. He hit her when he broke free from the head.
That scene where she's getting stitched up by the surgeon, and she's complaining about, I guess she's recently moved to L.A., and there's lack of trees and everything, and the doctor reminds her that, you know, he's like, you know, people forget that L.A. is a desert. We built the city on top of a desert. So, you know, I don't know what you... People, you got to remember that. I just thought it was kind of apt because right now there's that huge drought going on in California. You know, population growth, industry, everything is... They're kind of having to rethink how they do everything because you literally... I mean, it is a desert.
Well, that's technically not true. I mean, like, geographically, it's scrub brush. It's like South Texas. It has small, sparse trees. It's an arid region. It's not necessarily, you know, desert.
Look at the big brain Uncle D.
God, he's really going to keep this up.
The difference is 2% potential.
I was telling Cody downstairs, I spent all week working on my Pierce Brosnan accent, and then I watched the fucking movie, and he speaks French. Who could have seen that come?
No, it was kind of crazy.
He's not my James Bond.
It took me a little bit to get used to it.
You know, it wasn't a bad
French either. It wasn't. It actually wasn't.
He slipped out of it a few times. He spoke without it, I think that...
But for the most part, he carried it.
For the most part, he does. Anyway, I just thought that was interesting that they made this kind of little moment about, you know what, because now, like, what, Palm Springs is redoing all their greenery and landscapes, changing over to rocks and stuff. It's like, we got to change, you know, we got to do some stuff. I just found it very topical.
Yeah.
So, our announcer, Keith Howes, out there in California.
Stay thirsty, Keith.
Stay thirsty. If you need me to send you malt liquor or...
I can bottle up some tap water from the sink. Well,
you can probably send them care packages. Some beers. But that's really the only person I know out there, so that I care about. So anyway, she goes home that night after getting stitched up, and she, upon laying down, has her first vision where she is in a house and she sees a strange woman, bloody writing on the wall. It's a very quick flashback, and she wakes up in cold sweats, and that's when we know something has happened.
Very Manson-esque.
Yes, very Manson-esque. We learn the next day at breakfast when she gets up, she's meeting with some fellow doctors, that Pierce Brosnan, or Jean-Charles, was a world-famous anthropologist, spoke like a dozen languages, traveled the world, recently just moved to Los Angeles, and, you know, it was apparently kind of a big deal, and, you know, they kind of fill her in on this, and she's still kind of out of it, and then she starts her shift at work, And within, you know, a few minutes, she starts once again to slip into this hallucination. I guess hallucination is the right way to put it.
Yeah.
But it's she's basically seen things from Jean-Charles' perspective in flashback form.
And she still has motor skills. Because she has motor skills.
She's walking around
and all this
stuff.
She's
talking, yeah. but she's completely looking through his eyes and his memories. It switches later to where she sees him like from a third... It switches from like a first-person view of his memories to she's an observer, like a third person.
Yeah.
But at this point, she's watching all these things. And then eventually, she becomes overwhelmed. And in one of the world's longest... slow motion scene, she collapses at the hospital. And that was the first time I noticed McTiernan. I'm like, you know what? He loves slow motion.
Yeah.
A lot of direct, I mean, that's one of those weird things, not weird, but you don't see a lot of slow motion use. But I remembered, you know, Dylan in Predator when he turns to fight the Predator, that slow motion scene. I remembered Hans Gruber falling off the top of the Nakatomi Tower and slow motion.
That actually
which would come back in later.
Yeah, that totally.
But I was like, okay, you know, now I'm starting to see a little bit of personality from the director here. So basically what she was looking at before she passed out was him house hunting with his wife and the realtor showing him this really nice house in a nice neighborhood, Beverly Hills or somewhere in Los Angeles. And right when she sees that some punks have sprayed graffiti on the wall is when she passes out. I think the graffiti was like sex, death,
pigs kill,
Gutman's a hero, like kind of obscure things.
Wasn't sure what Gutman's a hero referred to.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I didn't know if that was supposed to be one of the, like Adam Ant, the killer, like was that...
I don't know.
If you know
out there in the Twitterverse... Unless Cody tells us right quick.
No, I was going to just say, that was the same thing. I tried, you know, kind of looking back at, you know, see if you could read, you know, some of the things.
There's not a lot of insight into this film online.
No.
Which, you know what, I like esoteric stuff.
It was an obvious kind of a... The imagery was very Manson, and I like that, because to me that's very spooky. For people our age, that was, you know, kind of ingrained into a Helter Skelter and all that.
My first thoughts were kind of cheesy, just the writing on the walls and not anything more. Once they showed Jean-Charles go into his garage and find some newspaper clippings.
Yeah.
With things about killings happening in the house, and they had written welcome on it.
Yeah,
it got a little bit creepier, a little bit nicer touch. And the more and more she starts having these visions, now she's... in a basically a coma in the hospital, bleeding out of her eye, hemorrhaging blood out of her eyes and ears. But she's still showing us all this revelations from Jean-Charles' life. She starts seeing this black A-team van patrolling the area.
Like the A-team.
Ad nauseum, like it's always around. It was responsible for the spray paint, and, you know, at that point is when they show her in the hospital bed. When I realized who she is, the actress, her name's Leslie Ann Down. And I was like, man, I know her from somewhere. She was Bronson's love interest in Death Wish 5.
Ugh.
The Face of Death, the last one. She was the fashion designer
who was doing all the runway shows.
And her ex-husband was Michael Parks, the guy from Dust Till Dawn, the sheriff, the Texas Ranger.
Yeah.
Full on nut job. He's a mafia boss, but that's where I knew her from. Was you're my special lady. Well, it's the fifth one, so she was like the fifth special lady to get killed.
Always.
God, what an unlucky group of ladies to hook up with this guy. But that's the only thing I recognize him. But she's a good actress and she's beautiful.
Yeah.
So, rather than let these young... And Jean-Charles sees the leather-clad punks down the street from him. And where everybody else kind of would give them a pass as just some ruffians or some hellraisers, he's an anthropologist. Not only is he an anthropologist, he's like the world's greatest anthropologist. And you know that because no matter where he goes or what he does, he wears like the beige cargo pants and the safari jacket.
He's always on the job.
He's always
looking for that next
And we
thing.
See stuff around his house, like pictures of him in Africa wearing the same outfit. Pictures of, you know, there's African tribal masks all over his apartment. And but the guy just, he's got the outfit. You know he means business. He looks like, what was the guy that used to be on Letterman? Jack Hanna, the
Zoom guy.
I mean, this guy is Mr. They don't have to tell us he's an anthropologist. You just look at him. And so rather than just let these guys start, you know, fucking with him with his new house, which, you know, a lot of guys would do, he grabs his camera in the middle of the night and starts chasing these guys.
When it's all ready to go, he pops it out of his little silver travel case and just, it's ready.
And screw that telephoto lens. I've got a 35mm lens on here. It'll zoom.
So he's off to the races. And he starts following them around downtown 1980s LA, which is kind of cool to see all the kind of the main strip. And he's taking pictures of them. This is all set to the first kind of 80s rock song on the soundtrack.
Yeah.
Stranger. Which
Mr. Nugent.
There's like three kind of big set piece rock songs written by Bill Conti, the composer, and Ted Nugent.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of guitar going on in this film. Yeah. Kind of like last week with AC/DC.
Yeah.
But you can hear it's the Nuge. Like the Nuge is very, guitar wise, very, he doesn't do the vocals. It's not him singing, but, So.
Well, here's a good spot for me. I'd never seen it. I'm a weird bird when it comes to horror movies because my imagination is so damn active. I can spook myself, you know, in Sunday school. So I was kind of curious about how I would take this because it's a supernatural suspense thriller, which is usually my scariest thing. Ghost stories, I'm a sucker for.
Really?
I'm a total sucker for. So all the way leading up until you actually see the guys, the spirits... I thought it was very good suspense. I enjoyed it. I could feel myself getting worked up because I'm outside on my deck in the dark, smoking a cigar, drinking some bourbon, and then all of a sudden, I see the spirits, and they're straight up 80s gang, leather clad. They look like a casting call from RoboCop.
This is a movie where the wardrobe choices of when it was shot,
yeah,
don't transfer well. Half t-shirts. I mean, these are guys you're supposed to be scared of. These are threatening,
well,
menacing.
But that's just it. At that point, when he first sees them, they just look like punks. You know, they're
shadowy.
They're leather clad.
Very well, but when finally do see them in their leather vests,
yeah, when he's following
half t-shirts,
yeah, when he's following them, and the director's choice is to make them look, you know, evil and menacing.
Yeah,
I mean, they're basically stabbing a dude in the head in the alley when he starts really getting to following them. But at the same time, due to the period, they kind of look a little comical. It's kind of like Sid Vicious up there trying to act badass,
but much
not
more
Sid Vicious.
No.
That's the rest.
Sid Vicious would have
whooped ass. Yeah.
I mean, that would have. This is more like Adam Ant.
What was the demolition dude? The demolition.
Simon Phoenix?
No, I was trying to think of the wrestlers, the old school tag team wrestlers.
Oh, the demolition?
Yeah.
Road Warriors?
No, not Road Warriors. They scared me.
Road Warriors scared
me? Yeah, what a rush, man.
But no, the
Road Warriors were going a little guar, you know, with the big spikes.
A little Road Warrior, man.
Well, I agree. They're when the main bad guy who's played by,
but I also think that was the on his part. You know, he's trying to identify them as the group. This is their group.
Yeah,
so they are all the same, so to speak. And
like I said, it wasn't just his choice. That was a very popular style back in the
80s. It was. They would have totally fit in. And it's like, well, if they're running around and doing these things, they would look like they fit in. So it worked for 1986.
Yeah.
Now, you know, it's kind of a, hey, check out these 80s. It doesn't transfer well. But did you guys notice, as he's following them around, first of all, I noticed also during the scenes, they started doing some of the faster zooms, like up to Pierce Brosnan stuff, and I was like, I immediately recognized that stuff from like Last Action Hero, those crazy kind of really fast.
I noticed the transitions, like, you know, he was, you know, he would shift the focus in screen. You know, you see, you know, Brosnan's character walking, and then, like, you know, he shifts it so that you see the bad guys off.
Yeah, a lot bunch of rack photos.
So it really, and you could, and that, like I said, that translates over so much to Predator, to Die Hard. Those,
I'm a sucker for good rack focus. So.
And you could just see him learning it and using it, and it's like, yeah, that was kind of comforting, or kind of cool, just to see it done on a much smaller scale, and something you hadn't seen. So that was really cool. Did you guys notice? He stays up all night following these guys. They never sleep.
Yeah.
He makes a note in his notebook. They never sleep.
Yeah, it was 30 hours.
But, like, the next day, it's around lunchtime, I guess, and he's following these jokers around L.A. He gets a hot dog. Did you notice the most bizarre hot dog tracking shot you've ever seen in your life?
Yeah, it was, like, waist shot.
He gets a hot dog from a hot dog stand. He holds it waist right in front of his crotch. He holds this hot dog, and he walks, and we pan, and we follow him with it. And I don't think it was for any kind of...
I actually don't think it was a conscious...
It wasn't a conscious thing.
It wasn't a statement.
But who, when they were editing this thing, was like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, we're going to follow him with this...
Tracking wiener shot.
That's what we need to do. It was a smooth tracking wiener shot.
Very, very well done.
I'm not going to lie, I've seen better.
If you're going to track a wiener, you need to do it smoothly.
I'm going to interview that Dolly guy on a project I got coming up. I heard you did the 30-foot wiener tracking shot back in 86.
It's like I was 22 years old.
It was my best work.
The money.
Look, do you want the job or not, kid? No, but it was just a really weird this follow shot of Brosnan holding this wiener down at his crotch.
I was trying to figure out if he was trying to say something with the scene.
Well, no, and I was like, you know what?
Is there something? Because after you know that the couple of seconds, you're like, this is kind of weird.
Yeah.
Is there a point to this? I hope there's a point.
Yeah.
And then there is no point. You're like, I was just staring at his crotch.
Sometimes you just have to do gratuitous wiener shots.
Yeah. And I rewound it like 10 times trying to find the meaning in it. I took some screen grabs. I'll throw them up on the website. But it was a great, it was a really cool tracking bizarre hot dog wiener shot. So he's following him around.
Did you just say no dick pics?
I did say no dick pics. So while he's doing all this, Dr. Flax, who's now embedded with his
his memories.
She's escaped the hospital, and now she's hanging out at the beach, just kind of huddled up, just experiencing all these flashbacks and visions. So through her, we continue to follow along with Jean Charles as he follows these punks, and all of a sudden he sees them kill a guy in an alleyway. I mean, they're all kind of huddled over this dark alley, and they take what looks like a railroad spike or some sharp object, and they just stab this poor bastard right in the forehead. And Jean Charles, who's been doing a really good job of staying low-key, he's an anthropologist. He knows how to observe without interfering. All of a sudden, he just runs out there.
And I was like, you know, if you're running around the globe tracking down indigenous tribes all across, you're going to see them, like, do things. I figured that the natural instinct would be not to interfere.
Right. I think if anybody, like, in a horror movie, that's like your always instinct, like, I've got to help. But I think he's Jean Charles. He's wearing that pith helmet. And we didn't have pith helmet, but he's wearing the Panama Jack outfit. He should know not to interfere with what's going on. But no, he tosses the camera aside and runs out there like, stop it, you're maniacs. And of course they all look and they start chasing him. Which I thought led to a really tense kind of scene where he crawls under, they're chasing him through downtown L.A. And I love that it's all taking place in the city.
Yeah.
And there's cars, like, going by. Like, no one seems to acknowledge that there's people around. You can ask for help, but it's just like he's kind of in his own little world. And he slides under this car. He gets around a corner from him. He slides under this car. And they do this a lot in the movie where the soundtrack becomes just his heartbeat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I was told from a very young standpoint, filmmaking-wise, that is the cheapest most don't do it stunt as a filmmaker you can do is play Heartbeat on your soundtrack. I did it in my first horror movie I did in college, Smoke Some Kill, and my editors were like, yeah, all right, where do you really want to use, because I was insistent that it worked, but they're like, oh, you're using it way too much. Use it one place where you really want to amp up the thing. But they use it a lot every time he's kind of stressed out or doing something. Yeah. And I thought it worked. I thought it was a nice...
It worked so well that I didn't recognize it.
When he's under that car and they run past him, but then they come back.
Yeah.
And you can see where the car lowers, where they sit on the car and they like drop a cigarette. And he's just stuck under there. And then inexplicably they leave.
Yeah.
Which they do a couple times in this movie. They get him cornered and then they bail.
Yeah. That's kind of weird.
So they let him go. And instead of counting his blessings and calling the cops and being like, hey, I just saw some guy murdered and, you know, I need help. I'm a little over my head. I've been in town for 2 days. I need some help. No, he continues to track them. And follows them to another dark corner of downtown Los Angeles when suddenly... suddenly, the main... Michael Jackson's Thriller just came on the pub stereo, and everybody's just
kind of feeling it.
I think our waitress may be down there feeling it.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, he's photographing the group, and the main chick, the main spooky punk girl, does a full Tawny Katane from Whitesnake.
That you just said that, because I was telling my wife, I was like, yeah, I was really getting spooked and really getting intense into the first half of this. And all of a sudden, a Whitesnake video breaks out.
She crawls up on the hood of this car and with her huge 80s teased hair and starts dancing. And for some reason, he comes out of the shadows and is like just feeling it. And he's like snapping her.
Yeah.
And he's kind of got a little swivel to his step. And he's like loving it.
Give me sexy.
And another girl from the gang comes up to him. And she's like, eh. And he's like, yeah. And he's like smiling and taking pictures. It's like, I don't know what was going
weird...
on. And then it cuts.
Yeah, it's a weird.
And then it's over.
I mean, I guess it was to show that these guys, hey, we're having fun and we're drawing you into this.
I don't know what it was for.
I think that's...
That's what I took out of it.
Yeah.
You
started out following us, but now we're kind of... Now we know that you, and we're going to...
That would have made sense if it went anywhere, but he never...
Yeah,
he never joined them. He never, like... They didn't take him into their wing. But at that point, no.
It was still very antagonistic.
It made no sense. Especially when, you know, it cuts and then he's back at home.
Well, I think that was kind of... That was our beginning. That, for me, was, you know, in retrospect, after, you know, you get through the whole movie, you go think back to it. Like, that's where you start to see that it's wasn't just this all, you know, suspense and him chasing them, them chasing him. It was... There was this little bit of, you know, if we'll call it seduction.
A mind game.
Yeah.
Being played. So there is a potential interesting dynamic there that never goes anywhere until possibly the very end, which we'll get to. Let me take this moment before. So, you know, the chase is on. It's an extensive chase. A hunt, if you will, from an anthropological standpoint. That's a word. You can look it up. I had to look up your word copious last week. Copious amounts of smoke.
Copious.
It's a good word.
It's an excellent word.
I've been using it all week. My daughter the other night was like, she was still hungry, and I was like, I gave you a copious amount of SpaghettiOs. What are you talking about? Copious.
Speaking of, this has a nice little smoke roll off.
I want to touch back. Smoke production-wise, which was a big, not issue, a big positive of the Emilio AF1 last week, for a Connecticut cigar, this thing at one point had just billows of really cool gray smoke coming off of it. How are you guys feeling about the cigar? We're all for once about the same, about halfway in.
I have been practicing my Señor Blanco.
I thought this bastard would be going faster since it's such a, you know, right in his wheelhouse.
I am sticking to the whole mantra.
Like, I will say this before I get your opinions, like the AF1, the burn line, straight across, perfect construction,
yeah,
perfectly perfectly square. Yeah.
And I actually lit this. I borked my light.
No, I did too. I was talking too much, and I did. And I thought there might be kind of a tunneling concern and kind of sunken behind the ash. Immediately popped back out, and you know, it's good looking.
How construction wise, it's top notch.
Yeah. Start with you, Yax. How you digging it?
I am. This one is right in my wheelhouse. Before I lit it, I mean, it was the aroma. It was light. I got just a little, maybe like smell of like sweetness to it. It was in the cigar now. I'm not really getting any sweetness now.
Yeah. No, I'm not getting any sweetness whatsoever. But I am getting like a...
I get where you're coming from, though, on the initial light, though.
Yeah. I mean, it... But it's not sweet in any way. This one is just very, it is mild. I mean, let's just go start there. I mean, Connecticut, everything else, it doesn't have any tobaccos that are just going to melt your tongue.
No, for me, especially through the retrohale, I'm getting a little stronger than normal with the Connecticut. I'm getting a little bit of maybe like a white pepper, maybe like a pepper in, but it's nice. It's nowhere near overpowering. It's really nice. And there's something else I can't put my finger on. Maybe I'll get it here more.
Baked potato.
You getting a baked potato note on this thing?
I actually am.
Are you? I've never.
It tastes like a good spiced baked potato.
Interesting.
In a good way. In a good way.
I love it. That is a cigar profile, a note that I've never heard in all my years.
Probably never will again.
Is a baked potato, a loaded baked potato, or just baked potato?
Not just baked potato. It's got a little bit of sour cream in there, a little bit of cheese. No, not really.
No bacon.
Maybe some green onion.
Really? I would really like to taste a baked potato coming off.
That seems more of an acid kind of like. An infused experience.
No. Not
the acid Spuds McKenzie.
No, it's not infused to where, you know, you put your lips to the cigar and you taste it on your lips.
They're the jelly beans of cigars. This is our baked potato.
well, fucking hey, that's awesome.
I think because I might have half retrohaled because I was trying, but I didn't want to look, you know, bad on video. So it got about like a half blow through there.
It's very, it's a very warm kind of. I will give it a kind of a vegetable kind of garden kind of
maybe earthy.
Yeah, but not earthy. Like the AF1 was earthy. It was kind of a dark.
I always
earthy.
Get confused on these descriptors.
Vegetal, or it does have like a
vegetal.
Vegetor.
He-Man
totally.
Character?
That totally sounds like a comic book.
I'm Vegetor.
The Plant Man. Wasn't there?
There was a Plant Man.
Me and Poison Ivy and Swamp Thing are going to meet up after the show.
Damn you, Vegetor.
Moss Man. That's who it was. Moss Man. I remember him.
No, it's really good, especially coming from... I'm not that big on Connecticut's.
Well, the fact you find anything interesting is a bonus.
Yeah.
And would you say this is not your father's Connecticut?
I guess. I'm not sure what my father's Connecticut is.
I guarantee it wasn't baked potato. Well, good. And the beer, we just got our second pint of beer. Is it too early to...
No. This beer's a knockout. I'll tell you that.
You like
it's a knockout. I'll definitely hit it again. It's great. It is crisp. It's clean. It's light. It is a great summer beer. Unless you like fruitiness, unless you like lemon and citrus and all that good stuff, because you're not going to get it with that. You're just going to get a full, nice beer flavor. It is. I'm loving it.
I praise coming over there from Tut. He's loving it.
Especially I geared towards the darker beers.
I will say this. Last week you had mentioned with the 1554 that you said, thank God we finally have a dark beer that doesn't taste like coffee.
Yeah, yeah.
And to me, this is the same thing as opposed to the IPA and the Hefeweizen.
Yeah.
We finally have a lighter beer that's not citrusy.
Yeah.
And it's not so hops loaded.
And a lot of floral nut. It tastes like a non-light beer. What we grew up, you know, just a beer.
Yeah.
But it's crisp. But it has a crispness to it that is refreshing. And I think you miss that on a lot of beer. Like, it has a very definite crispness.
I stock two different kinds of beers. Well, I stock more than two different kinds, but there's two different categories that I put them in. I have my go-to just run-of-the-mill beer. Canned beer, I'm not ashamed. It's just, you know, working out on the lawn, there you go. And then I have my craft beers and my flavorful beers. I would take this, and the reason why I do the canned deal is that it's a real light beer. You can do it working. You can do sure. it, you know, out in the yard. I'll replace it with this.
All right. I'm not quite there with the enthusiasm.
I love you, Karma.
But I am liking it a lot. I think I need a little more time with it and the smoke.
The only bad thing that I'll say about this beer is, and I'm sorry, I'm going to alienate one big, very large fan base, is that it's from Houston.
Well,
can't please everybody, obviously.
No, I mean, it's the greatest major city in the state of Texas. That's undeniable.
They have no Migas in Houston.
They have Migas. They just don't talk about them incessantly. And they eat them and forget about them.
There's no Gordos in Houston.
There are.
There's no Migas on top of donuts.
They just don't make them.
Have you been to Houston?
Big deal out of them. For our new listeners, or for those of you who haven't gotten too big into the history of the Two Cent Cigar Club, Tut recently, I say recently, within the last, what, year?
Yeah, about a year and a half.
Has moved to Austin.
First time in a big city.
He's gone a little overboard. A little too excited.
Metropolitan Tut.
And people like Tut are the exact reason why Cody and I don't go to Austin anymore. boy, it really peaked there in the late 90s, didn't it?
It's good times then.
Mid to late 90s, Austin was just phenomenal.
It was. That's when I will say Austin was weird, but not pretentious about it yet.
Oh, that's yeah.
Why are you looking at me?
They didn't need bumper stickers to tell you they were weird.
I don't know what you're talking about. I will get the bumper sticker next week.
And they certainly didn't have Keep Austin Weird bumper stickers on $50,000 SUVs driving around town.
Yeah.
Nothing weird about that. Actually, everything's weird about that. Oh, what a just a. A sad story that is, but I'm glad you guys are enjoying it.
I think we should transition back to the movie now. So
let's do that.
Now that we alienated two of our large Texas fan bases.
No, well, you alienated Houston. I'm a huge fan, as Cody is, because we're reasonably.
He lived in Houston.
Reasonable guys. I did. I lived for about 10 years in Houston. I love it. I miss it sometimes. But you know what? Move to Texas, folks. If you're listening to this from out of Texas, there's something for everybody here.
Oh, yeah.
And on that note, Jean-Charles wakes up the next day after this mind game of tracking the punks, the ghost punks, which you would find out a little bit later are ghosts. And
spirits.
The spirits.
Did it ever qualify what kind of Inuit, I guess?
A ghost. They're ghosts.
Well,
to get to the Inuit thing, so let's just put that on hold for one second.
Because I was kind of curious about that.
So he finally stumbles home in the morning. And, you know, like most of us, when we stumble home after being gone for 30 hours. His wife's a little upset.
Just lights into him.
And she just starts smacking the shit out of him. And I swear at one point it was like Naked Gun where... He grabs two wrists and a third hand comes out in the middle and starts slapping the shit out of him. Like there was one moment where it made the hands didn't add up.
Jen, don't get any ideas.
This little French woman really just starts pummeling the shit out of him with good reason. And you know, you would think she would be used to him. It seems like a normal thing for him to grab his camera and disappear for days on.
Well, I think she found out
the newspaper clippings.
Yeah. That freaked me out.
Of the murder that went down in the house.
Yeah.
So that certainly didn't help anything. So she's slapping the shit out of him, Naked Gun style. And basically, he fills her in on what he's observed. And he's like, you know what? They're nomads. Like the nomads we've observed in Africa and everywhere we've lived. He's like, even in this huge city, they're nomads. And they have no homes. I looked it up. Their car, the A-team van they drive around in, has no record with the DMV. And they act with violence, recklessly, at a drop of a dime, and they never get caught. And as she's saying this, she's getting it. Like, they've seen this before.
Yeah.
And, you know, somehow he neglects to say that he saw them kill a man and dump him in a dumpster.
Well, he doesn't want to scare her. I mean, and that's been played out earlier in the movie.
That's true.
He's taking some steps.
It seemed to me like he forgot that a little too easily, but... So next thing you see him is he calms her down and they're fine again. God, if only it were that easy, right? You disappear for 30 hours and like within 2 minutes your wife's cool with it. This is science fiction. This is fantasy.
Supernatural.
This is fantasy.
I need that power.
So next thing you see, he's in the bathroom and he starts like, he's got these funnels and he's doing all this stuff and I'm like, oh shit, classic Maternan and booby traps. Like McLean with the C4 and the elevator, or Dutch, you know, with the knives trying to capture the prey. Like, he's making booby traps.
All of a sudden, I expected him to start, like, loading up his little vest.
And they did. He was, like, taking camera things out and putting them in his vest. I'm like, this is 80s. This is McTiernan written all over it.
the ammo montage.
Starts painting.
Well, we'd learn later, I got really, the wind was deflated from my sails. It was just camera developing equipment. He was processing film. There was no booby traps. I was really bummed out when I saw that. But in the meantime, Dr. Flax, the doctor who's still wandering around the city, hallucinating and aimlessly, her potty-mouthed coworker, Cassie, that is the one trope Spunky. As a first-time screenwriter I noticed, like, every line out of this chick's mouth is fuck this, and even like in like the hospital, she's the physician. She's like, you know, did you guys order fucking breakfast yet? I need my fucking coffee. What the fuck is going on here? She's like, what? Are you fucking okay, baby? Every day, it's like, oh god. Well, she's somehow finagles her way into Dr. Flax's apartment looking for her, and they get a phone call from a professor in Boston. Who Dr. Flax had reached out to apparently during this hallucinatory.
Had called.
He called an old colleague, and he was calling to let her know what he had found out about the phrase that Pierce Brosnan had whispered into her ear before he died. This whole time they thought it was a place. They thought it was a place in France or something, and he did some research, and he's relaying this to the potty mouth doctor on the phone. And apparently it wasn't what they thought she said. What they actually said was Inuit. And she's like, what is that? And he's like, Inuits are an Eskimo.
Well, it was a phrase, and they thought it was a French. It was a French phrase. Mm-hmm. And they thought it was a place. But it was like, no, there's no record of French, but there is an Inuit. Yeah, I guess it was an Inuit.
Yeah, I was right.
Damn it.
See what I have to deal with? It was. He basically says it matches an Eskimo terminology. And she's like, Eskimo? He's like, yeah, the Inuits. They're an Eskimo. It's a nomad myth. It's a term for hostile spirits that can assume human form, ghosts, basically, possessed people. And they inhabit places of past, I think they put it like past calamity disaster.
Yeah. Well,
And they bring disaster and madness to those living in that thing. So basically, sum it up, you moved into a haunted house where killings took place. These spirits live there, and because you are inhabiting this where something horrible happened, these Inuits, these ghosts, are going to destroy you. It's Poltergeist.
I like the way they...
And you know, and this is why... What I really took out of that whole scene afterwards as I was thinking about it is, like, that's, you know, that very much almost, it's almost Predator to a T.
I mean, go on. Keep talking.
You could almost, like, I mean, what I took out of it is like, well, you know, it's kind of what they describe about the Predator. It's basically he's an invisible monster that seeks out violence.
They described him as a spirit.
And essentially, that professor on the phone, who's John McTiernan, by the way, that's his voice.
No, I didn't know that.
It's basically equivalent of the girl in Predator telling the stories her village.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a lot. There is a lot of tie-in.
Look at you.
There.
Ah. Well, that's just what I took out of it.
Just you. Very similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't pick up on that, but now that we're going through it, yeah,
Anna.
It's very.
Anna is the girl from Predator. But same thing. She tells a story of these invisible creatures who came in and unleashed
nomads,
bloodshed, and
they take the men from our village.
Yeah.
In the hottest years, this happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
And that's basically what he's saying. So,
I also like the way it reinforced. There's a line that Brosnan delivers early in the film that says that they're attracted to the house.
He does. He's like they're coming for the house. But basically, through that conversation, Cassie, the foul mouthed, she reminded me a lot of Lyndall Hamilton's roommate.
Exactly.
Terminator.
I was just about to. Yeah.
Did she
just
remind you of the roommate in Terminator?
Just the spunky sidekick.
It
was similar. And I kind of got that from like the intro, like when they first start going around driving. It just felt like Terminator, like them driving around.
It had a lot of, because it was L.A. and it had a lot of the same scenery and a lot of the same, right around the same time period. Like it had a very, you know, we keep going back to Terminator with a lot of these films. Like it had a lot of that same kind of vibe. But she reminded me a lot of that aerobics.
Now, if she came out and just put on the headphones and started dancing way down the hall, but like,
well, she's gonna have a fun scene here in a minute. But you know what? So basically, but here's the thing: she at that moment realizes what was whispered. She tells us what she translates, because I forgot to mention she knows French for some reason. Convenient.
Apparently, most potty doctors do.
But she
is that to say, excuse my French?
That thing you said with Predator that was so good, you just wiped that out.
Sorry.
She pieces together what Jean-Charles whispered to Dr. Flax, which was, they're not there.
Yeah.
They're Inuit. Or Inuit. Which is, they're ghosts.
Yeah.
Which, they keep that camera on her for a good 30 seconds as she's soaking in that information. And you're like, she's getting this.
I love that.
And she's realizing the heaviness of what's happening. But then she gets up and she's like, ah, crap. Double crap. Crap, 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 crap. And she completely forgets.
But see,
whatever importance was on her shoulders a second ago is gone.
No, I don't. I think that it did a really good job of going into that. She's getting this. Oh my gosh. There's something going on here. And then she realizes what she's thinking, and then she was like, no, that's not real.
That's a good point.
Boom.
That's a good perspective.
Yeah.
This can't be, you know, when you're faced with something that can't be real, you have no choice but to just get kind of quirky.
Yeah, and I thought they did a great job, because that's really hard to get across, especially when you don't say, oh, that's not real. Now, if she would have said that, I think it would have been kind of like a, you know, slap
but
in
I
a
see,
carp
and see, like,
against
that, that's the first time in the movie that you start, you get... Because up to this point, there's nothing supernatural other than the fact that this woman is having visions of a dead guy.
Yeah.
But and so this is the first time you see here, which is now supposedly reality.
If we were having something happen to the Tuesday Night Cigar Club that was defying reason, and Cody was missing, and a lot of weird stuff was going on, and I got a phone call that said, look, Cody tried to contact us. There's an old Czech ghost that inhabits the third generation of all Czech males and this and this. I would probably listen intently like she did. And you're right. I would be like, no.
Cody, hope I get that call, because I'd be like, oh, Lord, there's ghosts after Cody.
Yeah, I hope he gets that call.
He just tells me he's going
to
leave me for dead.
Why would you turn into Fred Sanford?
I'm a believer. My wife likes to giggle at that.
Well, you know what? I thought that was a poor direction from him, but
see, I think
your,
it was actually
your
pretty
perspective
good.
When the only option is the unbelievable, sometimes you have to just switch. You know what? I want to stay sane here.
Yeah.
Let's switch that off. and just forget it.
Because I think he really had only two choices. Either go and do that, switch it off, or say, oh, I don't believe this. And I think that would have been way too heavy-handed. And
it's a very good point.
I like what he did with there. You. I like what he did there.
I think that's good.
And kudos to the little actress that pulled that off. I thought that the whole scene worked for me.
Okay. Now it does for me. So we're on the same page. We go back to Jean-Charles in his bathroom photo developing lab, and all of a sudden he realizes that he develops all the film he took over those 30 hours of chasing the guys, and all of a sudden he realizes they don't appear in any of his photographs, like a vampire, basically.
Yeah. Did the dead guy show up?
I don't know if he... No, remember he put that. His camera down when
yeah.
the guy got killed.
Oh, that's right, that's right, that's right.
You think... A murder scene, he would be clicking away, but no, he stopped filming at that. And, but no, they don't appear anywhere. So at this point, he freaks out. You know, his wife's just now starting to forgive him. And what does he do? He just takes off for this moonlight jog, which, by the way, he puts on his safari jacket again.
That's you never know.
You don't own a pair of sweatpants or
that's what I'm saying.
A tracksuit or a t-shirt. He's
running.
I gotta
down.
Go out for a jog. Let me put on my.
He's running down through smog-filled '80s LA in full anthropologist gear. That's the one I love. But I will
obviously
say
he's used to it. I mean, that's his uniform.
All right, now did I go?
It is his uniform.
Did I go a little too heavy during that scene? It's nothing but him breathing. And it's just, you know, it's showing Brosnan running through L.A., kind of towards, I think it's like a beach or a park. And all you do is you hear him breathing. There's no other noise going on. I thought that was kind of
Kubrick-esque.
Yeah. With
either term's acceptable.
I mean, of course, like with, you know, 2001, it was far more... context.
Now, are you talking about, because during this run they start chasing him, are you talking about during the chase
or
while he's running?
Just while he's running.
No, I saw nothing Kubrickian about
I thought it might have been a poor execution of just the breath with no, because that's the only scene that I related to.
Oh, from a sound design standpoint, yeah. You found it Kubrickian?
Yeah.
Okay, that
was the only scene I could relate that choice, because you're in the middle of a city, so you're going to block out all the city sounds, just him breathing. I'm not exactly sure what the director was trying to do there.
I'll be honest, I don't necessarily remember that element of it. I remember him running in that full safari outfit.
That's why
I do remember a lot of traffic being around. Like even when he like stops running, he's out of breath.
Yeah,
he's in a little just a intersection, basically a little park.
That's why I
and
didn't
his car's
think that,
zipping around. Like that's what I love about. You know, they call this genre of film an urban fantasy because it's fantasy stuff that takes place in the middle of city and society. I mean, even when the Intuits or the ghosts are disappearing, you know, teasing in behind trees and stuff, there's still traffic everywhere. Like he's in the middle of the city.
And see, that's why I'm confused by that whole scene. Is that, you know, maybe he was. You know, just it was trying to represent that he was alone in his thoughts as he was trying to get through it. Because
there's
so much. Because the reason why it worked in 2001 is that you're in the vacuum of space. There is no sound. There's nothing going on. But here, you're in the middle of L.A. There should be traffic all the way.
That's where you're getting the Kubrick, and you're thinking of, you know, when he's trying to disconnect how the.
Yeah.
Okay, I never even thought of that.
Yeah, I'm probably superimposing my own thing.
Well, what first
time
filmmaker isn't trying to pull a little Kubrick into their
But now universe. Now that I think about it, I think he was just trying to represent how alone in his thoughts he was. He was trying to think and process all the stuff he's
Well, very soon after he's running, he's going for his jog, the A-team van bursts through some barriers and starts chasing Remington Steele through LA. And
what is this van coming after me?
Well, I don't know what it is, but maybe if you didn't run down the middle of all the streets.
Yes, that's, once again, it falls within the, it's like, I understand in terms of, you know, filming.
We talked about last week with Maximum Overdrive, they're semis. You can go places where they can't go.
Run in a Z, sweetie.
If you just run down the middle of the street, maybe a sidewalk might be an option.
Or maybe, why is it every street he runs down happens to be the most deserted street ever? Any person run, I always say, why do they? It's like, okay, I can run. If I go to my left, I'm going to run into a crowd full of people. Instead, I'm going to run down the dark alley.
Well, that dark alley he finally runs down, he gets inexplicably led to this doorway in an alley, and he goes in, where he's met by Francis Bay.
Yeah, this whole scene was a little weird.
Well, but I thought it's an old covenant. It's an old nun's covenant that he stumbles into.
Can I interject something real quick before we go into the covenant deal?
Sure.
All right, if he's starting to realize that these guys are spirits and that these guys are ghosts, all right, so is the A-team van a ghost van? And if he just stops and says you're ghost and you're not real, I'm not running from you, what happens then? If he would have gone...
I don't think they're like Freddy Krueger, where if you deny their existence, they lose their power. I think they could still kill you.
Yes.
All right.
They're vengeful ghosts that can kill it. Freddy gets his strength from your fear. That's kind of unique. I don't think these guys, if you're like, no,
that
sir,
chance, no man,
you are not real, and I'm going to stand here in the middle of the road. They killed that bastard in the alley.
That's true.
These guys are...
They killed the people in the house.
I really took away that they're more... They're spirits, but they're also... And they say they, you know, create mischief and things like that. I took away that they're almost more like gremlins. Not the green little creatures.
We've already talked about this on two shows, dude. They're called little people.
No.
Now I'm just picturing all the nomads.
I'm not
with
talking
the
little about
little
green
the
monsters. Man. I'm talking about the sense of the gremlins. They create mischief, but you never see them.
Yeah, they're kind
of
like Viking
the Twilight.
Sprites.
Yeah, take the Twilight Zone Shatner.
Yeah.
There's something on the wing. He can see it. Nobody else sees it. It's destroying the plane.
He can deny it all he wants, but that plane's going down.
That's right. Yeah, he saw the monster. All right.
But this is why the nun scene is important that we're getting into. She flat out tells him, there are things in this world going on that we don't see. You, asshole, with your cargo pants and your safari jacket, choose to look too deep. And the fact that you saw them,
now you've got
due to your own nosiness, now they know you and you're in deep shit.
Not only that, but everybody around you.
If you'd mind your own business like everybody else and just painted over your garage door their graffiti and stuff, you'd probably be all right. You had to run out there and snoop. Now you know them, but more importantly, they know you. You need to change your name. She says them. You need to change your name, change your job, which, with that wardrobe, look, baby, I got a closet full of cargo pants and these fishing jackets. What else am I going to do?
I have no qualifications.
I'm going to work in Academy.
Is in that other gray case?
I see him going into Academy. Like, what are your qualifications?
I'm an anthropologist.
That's all I can wear. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Nada.
Nada, what are your opinions on cargo pants and safari wear in general for guys?
It's a very,
sound
it's
advice.
A very
sound advice. Sound advice. Always sound advice from Nada.
So you go to an academy and they just kind of pull over the anthropology, or actually that's a store, the anthropologist wardrobe.
I just think, what else could he do? It's all the clothes he has.
Well, what I really liked about that is that the one thing that took me a little bit, other than the French accent to get used to, and in full disclosure, we're watching it decades past when it was released.
Well, you know him as James Bond.
Not just that, but just the... I had a hard time buying that the evil spirits were evil because they were so comical in the timeliness of it.
Correct.
But when she says, if you've never run from anything,
she sold it.
Yeah.
She's basically, he goes into this, he breaks down the door, he goes into this covenant. There's a blind nun.
And that was
the creepiest thing in the movie.
Yes.
She's Frances Bay. You would know her better as Happy Gilmore's grandma.
Did not know that.
Did dude, it's Happy Gilmore's grandma.
How could you not see that?
I did not see that.
She's
I,
been
I
in everything. My favorite thing of her is In the Mouth of Madness.
Because that was the first thing when I first saw her like on screen, I giggled a little bit, like, hey.
Because I heard her with those pictures
but
of
then
beer.
She starts going down her little story lane. I was like, holy crap.
That's
creepy.
But my favorite role of her, I mean, she's been in hundreds of things, but I immediately know her as Miss Pickford from In the Mouth of Madness.
Yes.
John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness. Sam Neill, because you know she's this crazy woman that chops up her husband, and this she's a small town hotel innkeeper. And there's a scene where Sam Neill, very Pierce Brosnan esque in this film, is he's ringing the hotel desk thing trying to get her out of there. Miss Pickford, get out of here, you dumb old bitch! It's a fucking phenomenal scene, but she's Miss Pickford, so I saw her, but she's a little bit younger in this, obviously.
Yeah.
But I got it, and I was like, she starts delivering this. Like you said, when she tells you, you better run. Yeah. I'm not talking like be a little afraid. Change your fucking name. Change your job, as hard as that will be, and get the fuck out now, and you might be able to live through this. And she's leading around this creepy covenant by he's got a flashlight. She's making tea in the dark. Like, they left this chick with no electricity because she's blind.
Well, that was over here. That's
a running joke.
She couldn't see them.
She couldn't see him. That's why she's still around. And then, after some, you know, well, basically, she tells him, you look too close, you're too nosy, and now they know who you are, and that's your big mistake.
Then it goes through the montage, right?
Well, she's like, you're a marked man. And then very quickly, there's quick flashes, which...
See, I was thinking that the spirits came to that covenant and basically killed all the nuns and left her alone.
It's not really explained, because all of a sudden there's these really quick flashes of, like, nuns running through the covenant, flashing their boobs, human skulls. There's, like, a 10-second quick imagery.
I think it was just to kind of give you this idea that something... It's kind of like the thing with the house and the... newspaper clippings. Something happened here.
Yeah.
Something bad.
It is. Yeah.
But it was something like basically was
stylistic,
perpetuated by the spirits.
Stylistically, and you'll see this in a lot of first-time films from first-time directors, it was stylistically totally different than anything else in the film. This weird Lynchian kind of imagery of naked nuns and skulls. But you know what? It woke him up. He wakes up and he's in his car. He wakes
like
up
like a nun hanging there.
Yeah, there's a nun hanging. There's just weird.
I thought I took away from that they attacked the nunnery.
Oh, I took it as this nunnery was clearly the covenant was nearly deserted for years
because they attacked it.
Could be.
Mother. She lived because she was blind.
She lived because she's blind. She didn't see anything.
To me, that's more spooky. I like that.
She says at one point, like, they left me behind to watch over the place. How ironic. You know, I'm blind.
Anyway, suddenly I got blinking from Men in Tights,
guessing. You may have hated the Happy Gilmore's grandma scene, but I dug it. I thought it was really creepy.
Yeah.
She kept receding into the dark. Like, I kept waiting for something to jump out of the dark. Like, this is supposed to be, if you're considering this a horror film, there's not a lot in this movie
that
I consider horror.
I like
that
it was
had a haunted house feel to it. To where she would lead him through a doorway and then disappear in the dark, and I kept waiting for something to jump out of the shadows. Yeah. Like that whole covenant scene was awesome. I think that,
and this is what I was trying to explain to my wife. There's a difference between horror flicks that are stingers and then horror flicks that are suspenseful. I'm a sucker for the suspenseful. Once you establish that you're a stinger-type movie, then I expect it. And then, yeah, it's a cheap thrill and it's a cheap scare. But after that, I'm like, all right, it's just a stinger. This was kind of cool because you did get that. You got the shadows kind of imposing in. Carpenter did a lot of stingers, but he also did a lot of the reveals, like Michael coming out of the shadows. But it wasn't like a bam. It was just a boom. And I like you said, she was receding into the shadow. She was drawing back.
And they never
did
the stinger thing.
And I love the fact that they didn't resort to stingers.
They did do
this.
A stinger, which was really cool. It kind of left me on the edge of my seat. And I was like, I'd kind of like to see a straight horror film from John McTiernan, because he showed like some...
I agree, because to me, with the lack of stingers, it just builds tension and builds tension and builds tension and builds tension. And there's not that release. Because once you get the stinger and you have the... bam, going through there, then it's like, okay, now I can breathe because I just got the stinger. Yeah. And the only thing I have to worry about is the counter stinger that comes after.
I go with that.
Suspense, I love suspense.
I go with that a lot, which is why that scene works so good for me. So, real quick on the cigar. The beer, I'm starting to catch up with you a little bit as far as I'm realizing, you know, third pint. It's not only is it not getting boring, but that crispness is what I don't know what they do to get that.
It's fresh.
It's got a very crisp, refreshing bite at the very front end. And then like last week, there's no aftertaste. It makes you, it's a great, like you said last week, as far as the 1554, it's a great talking and drinking beer on the darker side.
Yeah.
This seems like a kind of a other side of the coin. This seems like a really good talking and drinking lager because, boy, when you first taste it, it's got that crisp, refreshing kind of bite, and then boom, it's gone. There's no aftertaste. There's no, you know.
Yeah.
It's like an Inuit of beers. It's there, but it's not there.
See, I'm not getting the vanishing point of it. To me, it's happiness in my mouth. It is good. I still got it just dripping in there. It's good.
He's really loving this beer.
I am. I am really, really impressed with it.
I'm about 2 inches left in the cigar. These were Toros we smoked tonight. 6-inch cigar. We're actually all kind of on par in the cigar. I have not picked up the baked potato, but... as a not a Connecticut, you know, smoker.
You know House of Emilio's going, baked fucking potato.
No, you know some little lady down in the Dominican who's scooping out potato skins.
She's
wrapping a cigar. She's like, finally. Finally. Those pendejos recognize what I'm up to.
Maybe I get the feeling that, you know, I told you, stop growing your potatoes next to the tobacco. How many times have I told you this? But it was just a little plot of land.
I have not gotten the baked potato, but if there's a such thing as a full-bodied Connecticut smoke, it's full-bodied. I mean, it's got a smokiness. The smoke production is out of this world.
That's the number one thing. I mean,
that's burning like crazy.
Yeah, even on the nose.
The ash line, you know, is perfectly straight. You know,
I'm still amazed that I lit this. I had a horrible light on it. Almost didn't get like a quarter of the bottom on it, and it still evened out, and it's burned just great.
And we're two for two though with House of Emilio as far as construction, because that's all talent of the rollers and. My God, man, it's a beautiful cigar.
Yeah, and it's. I don't know if I, due to terminology differences, if I would classify it as full-bodied, but it's definitely maintained a complexity of taste. I'm still not that big of a believer in Connecticut, but it is a very complex taste that I appreciate.
It's a full-bodied Connecticut, as compared to. Let's take the most standard Connecticut, a Macanudo, like
yeah. This definitely has
much fuller, much more medium.
On top of that,
it's got something that'll sink in your stomach with it. It's not a smoke it and forget about it smoke. I mean, it's got some body to it, which I guess is what they were going for, as far as you know, a stronger, more in your face Connecticut.
Yeah.
There's only so much you can do with the leaves you're working. I think they kind of achieved it.
Now, what I do like is I do like pairing this with the Carbach. I'm not, because I never want to fall into the trap that light beer, light leaf. I think that's a trap that a lot of people go into, and it's very easy to sit there and try to say, but I do like it, and I'm not exactly sure what it is pleasing that I'm really kind of digging about it. It's kind of I'm confused by the Connecticut leaf
this,
tactics.
Where I would normally equate a Connecticut cigar maybe to a yard cigar or, you know, lawn mowing cigar or hot summer grilling cigar, whatever. This, the full body of it and the construction and just the, you know, sometimes you can just hold a cigar and feel quality.
Yeah.
I would feel guilty lighting this up, mowing my grass, because it deserves more than that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Am I wrong in thinking that the Numb is starting to turn a little Fuente-esque?
I'm not there yet.
And Emilio, if I just insulted you, I'm sorry.
How could
I don't
you
know.
Be insulted if, comparing it to a Fuente?
Well, you know, a lot of people, any type of artisan craft, they don't want to be compared to any other artisans.
You know what? One day we'll do a podcast on my feelings about the word artisan.
Well, I don't mean like
aren't you enjoying your artisan beer?
I mean any type of creative class. I mean, when you're rolling tobaccos and you're blending tobaccos,
well,
that is a creative class.
I mean, it's a Dominican. It's
I know artisan
Dominican.
Is a very, you know, cliche, you know, word to throw around.
I mean, it's made in the Dominican, like Fuente. I mean, it's going to have. I don't think that's a stretch. I'm not picking it up. But then again, my history with Fuentes is mostly limited to the Hemingway series. One day, for some reason, I don't know why, it never happened again. Tuttle gifted us all with some Opus. Was it Lost Cities? Or
I don't know. I can't remember. It was a good night.
It was a good night, but then the same night he chose to bring his wife up here and gift her with a $3 Flor de Oliva Maduro. And
I wasn't expecting her to go, "Where's mine?"
She was clearly not
sorry, baby.
Not sharing the joy of us Opus smokers. So,
well, you know, it's kind of hard when everybody else is sitting around going,
everybody's just orgasming with their cigars. Oh my God, this is amazing. She's over there with her little, you know, a little budget cigar. So I stood up to the plate and I gave her mine, and boy, her eyes. She tasted the difference.
She liked it, immediately.
So the way I see it, you kind of owe me an Opus.
You can tell the difference between a quality cigar and a budget cigar.
Of course. Of course, you can tell the difference between a quality beer and, you know.
That's the one thing that, even though I'm not a Connecticut dude, I appreciate this offering so much, because the burn line's great, the smoke's great, the taste is complex. So even though it's not in my wheelhouse, I can see where Cody, it would be right in his wheelhouse. And people that do like Connecticut's, I think they need to try it.
But in the spirit of, you get what you pay for. Like, you know, I can drink, you know, I think I've said on the podcast before, 4 years in college, the majority of what I drank was cheap booze and malt liquor, because that's what I could afford to pay my bills. I grew an affinity toward. I get made fun of a lot about my malt liquor tendencies.
Because he's not lying.
They
still like malt liquor.
They stick with you.
Yeah.
It got me through some hard times. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry. It, you know, so I can appreciate a glass of Mickey's malt liquor. But I can appreciate something that reminds me a little bit of Mickey's with the maltiness and the sweetness. But you know what? All of a sudden it's coming up with the bite and the crispness and the little nuances that you pay a little extra money for, and all of a sudden you're getting even this isn't an expensive beer by any means.
No.
What would a pint of Carbach cost you in a pub?
Here?
Yeah.
Five bucks.
Alright. $6 you get a 6-pack of Mickey's. The difference is I drink this, I taste transitions, I taste crispness, I taste, you know, different things that make me think. Mickey's, that first sip is going to taste like the first sip on the sixth beer. Nothing's going to change. You get what you pay for. It's like a cigar.
Yeah.
That budget cigar is fine. We all have humidors at home full of budget cigars. They serve a purpose. But when you're sitting and you're talking and you're an anthropologist, you're investigating things. You want something interesting. You want something that's going to take you on a journey, whether it's a beer, a cigar, or a kind of a cool movie.
And it comes to experience as well. You know, to a novice, that might have been just some Eskimo fishing on the ice cap. But to a world-class UCLA anthropologist, that was a dude who was running or trying to hide from nomads.
Well,
I worked really hard for that segue. That was the best I could do.
Well, after those quick flashes of
it worked.
When they get into later about the analogy of the fishermen in Alaska, sometimes they go out so far, and we're going to get to that in a minute. I should probably save it, but I think it's apt. Sometimes there's a mythology or a story told among Eskimo culture where if you travel so far out into the ice, you forget how far you've gone and you lose yourself. And once again, it's an analogy that's directed towards Los Angeles. And I'm going to get to that in a minute. But real quick...
Well, I think that's a good one, actually, because it's so vast.
It is. Yeah. And it's all transplants. It's all people that aren't from there that come there.
It's like Austin.
It's,
you know,
it's like Austin 2015.
It's exactly like Austin. Cody, do you remember the salad days of Austin?
Oh, do
Tower Records?
Oh.
Oh, you're almost sounding like the hippies on the forums now. And just like, you'll never know what it was like to go to a house party with Stevie Ray Vaughan playing there.
Well, you won't.
He's dead.
But there is a theory going around that he killed himself. He threw himself up into the propellers of the helicopter because it was headed back towards Austin. And he just couldn't deal with it.
No.
It's not my theory, but I believe in it.
Just like the nomads.
AlexJones.com. Check it out. Check it out for yourself.
Alex Jones. Google it. Google it.
Google it.
Death, death, death.
If you look closely, it was actually Stevie Ray Vaughan's helicopter that crashed into the second tower in New York City.
Google it.
Google it.
So he leaves the Covenant among images of nun boobs and random skulls, which, by the way, was the name of a kind of a jazz fusion band that Cody and I had back in college. Nun boobs and random skulls. I was nun boobs. Cody was random skulls. We were good. We played a few coffee shops.
We did all right. Eventually, we figured out people were not fans of the name.
Or the music.
Plus, we didn't know any songs.
And we didn't know any songs.
Quick, play a song.
So he goes home, and waiting outside his home, of course, is Adam Ant and the punks. And he proceeds to go into his trunk. He gets a tire iron. For a guy that directed Predator and Die Hard, one of the worst fight sequences, like directorial-wise, like... He beats Adam Ant with the thing, but the way it's cut and edited, like, it's a really bad fight scene.
It was... like you said,
Saw the tire iron connect, and it was, like, really weirdly shot.
But at the same time, you're talking about the dude's first time out.
I know, but I'm just picturing the scene with McClane and...
Yeah, but, I mean, and what's amazing is, like you said, it's the first time out. And we only go like a year. I mean, he gets this one up. It's in screen. It's in theaters.
Literally a year later, he's shooting Predator. Those dudes mow down half the Mexican jungle.
I mean,
he learned quick.
Well, yeah, there's probably a friend of his going, all right.
Well, I was picturing the scene with McClane here. And what's the ballet dancer in Die Hard? Alexander Gudengoff or...
What is his name?
The blonde-haired terrorist in Die Hard.
I didn't know he was a ballet dancer.
Yeah, it's what...
I can't even think...
Alexander Gudenhoff?
That's kind of cool. I like that.
Well, he's been in tons of movies.
Alexander Gudenhoff.
Yes. Yes, that's it. That's
right. I was right. Okay. But that scene where he wraps the chain around, like, that... Yeah. Such an orchestrated fight scene. Yeah. Like, if you look at this movie...
And maybe, you know, he'd find, you know... Let's say it. They got some good stunt coordinators.
It could have been...
Yeah, because I...
It could have been, hey, you know what, John? You've got 10 minutes to film the scene on the street and our permit's up. All right, just pierce... Do like this with the crowbar and we'll make it work. And they just couldn't make it work.
And like I said, it's his first time out. I mean, you're going to have... You're going to learn somewhere. I can forgive him because those scenes... Fight scenes are notoriously complex to do. Not like I've ever shot one.
I really can't say anything. My horror film Underbelly, there was a scene where the guy gets into a fight in his car with a hitchhiker. And in a wide shot, he pulls over the side of the road. And he's supposed to be this dramatic fight, and he throws him out. And literally, when you watch the footage, the door opened and this guy just plopped out the side.
Kind of like Cesaro?
I had to cut the whole scene because it was so bad. So,
well, they're very complex.
I understand. But anyway, so he kills that man. He clocks him over the head. He immediately goes upstairs into his house across the street, goes up to the bedroom window, looks down at a man who's still down there dead,
strips,
finally takes off his goddamn Panama Jack outfit, and stands there in a brilliant moonlight butt cheek scene.
Gorgeous. Gorgeous shot. The colors were great.
The way the framing was great. The way the moonlight cascaded over his butt cheeks was just sublime. dude, it was Atkins-esque from The Fog and Halloween 3. It was a Tom Atkins-worthy butt shot.
Yeah, and it was also an Atkins-worthy shot after he just killed a guy, and now he's going to go over and just climb on top of his sleeping wife and get some loving.
Well, Mincy, we're definitely incorporating this scene into Angel Dust, so do some squats, man.
Well, no, he's already doing lunges. He knows he has a moonlight butt shot in Angel Dust.
Excellent.
But no, see, he strips down naked.
I wear my Adrian Barbeau or Tutbo wig.
You can need some more of these pints to... So he stands there in the window, naked. We get a lot of Jean-Charles butt shot. But then he goes and he just decides he's going to bone his wife, who's dead asleep. Because that always goes well. After you've been gone for another 30 hours.
And also the fact that you're still covered in dead guy blood.
And so he makes his way down her chest. He kisses her and he makes his way. He's going down south to do something fun. And then he just... Breaks into tears and cries, which I know we've all been there.
You've been talking to my wife, have you?
If we just take... a 10-second timeout.
This podcast is cutting too close to home.
Everybody's crying at the table. And then it fades to black. He does not... Not only does he not pleasure her, I'm sure he freaked her out. I mean,
she's waking up thinking, wow, my husband's been crazy these last few days, but now he's turning normal. We're going to have some sex, and instead he just turns into a big crying mess right on top of me.
Tuesday night cigar club style.
Or as I like to call it, Wednesday mornings.
As I like to... Yeah. I don't know about you guys. When I get home on Tuesday nights, I go straight for the garage to take my clothes off, and then I go straight for the couch to sleep. I usually don't see my wife for about 48 hours after. We do what we do.
I'm newlywed, so in a new house, but usually, so I'm even standing in front of the window.
Even 48 hours, usually, there's still some crying involved. But nonetheless, we wake up the next morning in bed. You know, he sprawled out like he did get some action, but he didn't. And she probably thought it was a dream. It was so brief. But he goes to the window to see if Adam Ann is still down there on the curb dead. And then we transition. This is when the relationship between him and his new conduit, or the Dr. Flax. Reliving it, kind of, this is when it takes a dramatic shift. All of a sudden, it's her at the window looking down there. And she's in his bedroom with his now widow, Nikki, is his French wife's name. Yeah. And she's a really good actress. She did really good.
I thought so. Actually, this whole scene, it was interesting because I thought it was a little bit jarring to where it was like, wait, what?
And it's the first time
where,
like, the dream sequence and reality interact.
Right.
Worlds collided. And
right.
It's the first time that she's in his world for realsies, and the wife is like, you know, and she plays this really well. She's still so shattered from his death. She knows that Dr. Flax was with him when she died, and she's willing to let her into their house. She knows, you know, this chick's been through hell, obviously, and she's looking for anything at this point. So then, Dr. Flax starts freaking out. She's like trying to like hell to figure out what he whispered to her, what he wanted her to know, And then we cut to maybe the most important scene as far as exposition, explaining some shit in the movie, which is Jean-Charles and his wife on top of a skyscraper in downtown L.A., complete with, like, the telescopes to look at the skyline and all that. And I guess this technically took place after he killed Adam Ant. It would have been real time, like, that next day. And he's really fucked up, obviously. It's been a really rough couple days for this guy.
Well, he just, you know, a day prior or 2 days prior, he just saw a guy killed. Now, he just beat a guy to death with a tire iron who his body was not there.
Married guy, they're new in town, she wants to go sightseeing.
And he wants,
you can't say no. All right, we'll go to Disney World.
Listen, I killed
a bunch of dudes, and I haven't slept in days. All right, let's get in the car.
Let's do this.
Do you want to get mocha frappianos on the way? Yes.
Yes.
Sure. Why not? So they go to the sightseeing platform on top of this L.A. skyscraper, and that's when he gives the story about the Eskimo, saying there was a danger in going too far out on the ice, away from everyone. You go out so far, you don't know what's real anymore. And so it's like, all right, so all of a sudden it's starting to get a little more real. Then they're looking out the city, and he's like, this city is filled. This is a key line, and he's like, this city is filled with people who've wandered way too far from home. Which is true. It's Hollywood. It's L.A. It's filled with people from Nebraska, from Kansas, who come all the way out to this little corner of the United States to chase something or to find something new.
You might. Let's get a little closer.
A little closer. Okay. So I thought that was a very important point. And then, suddenly, one of the...
Spirits.
Yeah.
What's the word?
No, man.
Intuit.
Well, I always thought they were saying Inuit.
Inuit. That's what I was looking for.
Inuit are Eskimos, though.
Well, that's what I'm saying, but I didn't know what.
Yeah, and this guy looks like an Eskimo. He kind of the Inuit that they mean. He's got the big
Hector Mercado.
What's he from?
I did not recognize anything he had been in. The only one that I did recognize from the group of the spirits was a Frank Doubleday.
Who's Frank?
And he only had a small. You would remember him as Romero from Escape from New York.
Oh, was he in there?
He was the crazy
big haired guy.
Yeah. He was one of the spirits. Oh, man.
Talk about being typecast.
Yeah.
I mean, well, that's what I say. He didn't get much time. You would have to go back to the first murder scene to actually see him.
All right.
But yeah, that was the only one that I recognized.
Well, the dude on the skyscraper, I like that scene because when he moves from the left side of Bronson and puts himself between Bronson and Brosnan.
Why are you moving around me?
Don't look at
Why
me.
Why are you getting in between me and my wife?
There's a story about Eskimos.
Now you did.
Now you're cold.
But when he got in between Brosnan and his wife and then looks at the wife.
Brosnan.
When he gets in between Bond and his wife and then looks at the wife, it was like, oh shit, it got real now.
And that's when Jean-Charles takes the guy, throws him over the side, and it is a fucking picture-perfect recreation. Yeah. Or not recreation.
No, it was the original.
The original
one.
Of Hans Gruber falling off the Nakatomi Tower in Die Hard. Arms outstretched, slow motion.
Yeah.
Just falling
all
back.
You were looking for the music, the dun, 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 like...
It was a good shot. It was a good shot.
That's I think at this point you have to say that's a McTiernan shot.
Yeah.
He mastered.
I think so, yeah. And it was cool to see that, you know, this was the first take of it.
But that was another scene where they used that heartbeat as the only soundtrack was Jean-Charles' heartbeat pounding.
Yeah.
Perfect soundtrack. When he sees him going for his wife, that heartbeat, it worked. And then he throws him over and you've got that. And then, you know... What I love, it cuts to Dr. Flax and Nikki back at their house, and she's like cleaning herself up in the bathroom. That's the end of that scene. And after all this she's been through, Dr. Flax starts drilling Nikki about Pierce Brosnan's health.
Yeah.
It's like, has he been eating any new foods? Had he been eating any new foods lately? Does he have any allergies? Like, look, lady, you're way beyond food allergies.
Well, she's that's still a
woman of science.
Well, she's grasping for straws.
Anything.
She's just experienced these incredible visions.
As fools would say, any port in the storm.
And she's hoping.
This was any port in the storm.
Well, more to the point, she's, in her mind, praying that what she's seeing isn't real.
Yeah, well, that there's something logical that can explain it.
And there isn't.
You know what? Jean-Charles did start eating carrots for the first time.
Well, didn't she say, like, hamburgers wrapped in plastic? Something like I remember that line kind of thrown in there.
I remember that. I just thought it was odd. Like, you're this far along in this.
This BPA.
This crazy mind, you know, this insane journey. It's like, you know, did he have any, you know, seasonal cedar?
Alcohol. Was he doing drugs?
Was he eating sushi from gas stations? Anything.
Hey, can that do bad stuff to you?
Yes.
That might explain a lot.
You're living dangerously, my friend.
So while she's drilling his widow, Nikki, the phone rings, and it is Cassie, her foul-mouthed,
spunky, punky
co-worker. And all of a sudden, she's it hasn't been like she's searching for days, what we've seen. Like, police kicking down doors, like, oh, hey, you're there! I've been looking for you.
Every now and then, I've been making a random phone call.
Oh, so good to find you. And she's like, are you okay? And she's like, yeah, I'm all right. She's like, I'm coming to get you. It's like, nah, maybe you better not. No. You stay here. I'm coming to get you, baby. All right.
And see, it was after that point when she gets in her car and she's going over there, and then the spirits get to her, and you have that scene where she's in her car.
Why, you know, if you don't, you can deny them all you want, or you can not know this, but they'll get you. They're not.
Yeah.
That's a perfect example.
Well, that's really what was the scene that, you know, as I said when I saw that one, that's what I realized. It's more like Gremlins. They cause mischief. They cause bad things to happen. But nobody can see him. It's that whole thing, you know. Like I said before, it's the thing on the wing.
Yeah,
you know, she sits there, sees these people getting in her car.
Yeah, because
she goes off
they
driving.
They didn't physically kill her. They just caused the situation that did.
Well,
and that was the end scene. You know, you see her turn that corner, and there's that semi, and she runs right into the bumper. And that was the end of the scene, and you realize all people were going to see was this woman step on the gas, turn the corner, and hit a semi.
We go to her, just to catch the listener up. She's driving to pick up Dr. Flax. Much like the Terminator chick, she's rocking out to some music in her car, just really happy and just
I
loving
found my
life.
My friend, I'm going to pick her up.
And the Tawny Katane Whitesnake ghost comes up to her window to try to give her some flowers. And while she's telling her to fuck off, which she does, she's like, I don't want any. And then she's like, no, I said fuck off. I don't want any of your damn... the mouth on this doctor.
It just goes from that whole...
I don't want your fucking flowers.
I don't want any. Get the fuck out of my...
And then all of a sudden, the door opens, her passenger door, and Adam Ant comes in. She's like, what the fuck are you doing? What the fuck? And all of a sudden, she hits the gas and just plows into like a street sweeper and dies. So we go back, and we're at the house back, and... They're packing their suitcases. They're gonna get out of there. And all of a sudden, the Inuits, the ghosts, start surrounding the house
in force.
Not just the four or five
that
from
we've
the
seen.
18
that we've,
van.
That we've, now there's bikers
that we've seen. 90% of the movie, there's
this
been
was,
five or six
this
of these.
This was a straight up RoboCop casting call.
All of a sudden, there is literally 100 of these Inuit punk ghosts. Biker gangs come down the street. They're climbing up on the roof. They're smashing windows. They're coming to get these girls.
I was more impressed with the budget at that point because I'm like, how much leather do we have? Get more people over here.
It's like they saved
wrap them in it.
It's like they saved their entire budget to demolish this house at the end.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden, I mean, they're driving motorcycles through windows.
Through it. They're
dudes.
Coming up through the floors. They're busting through the ceiling.
I was expecting at some point the Humongous to come driving down the road. Cow skins, guys,
had a very Mad Max feel. Like, you know, if they had a bigger budget, they would have shot some stuff at street level with Humongous and, like, just flames coming out of trucks, but they didn't have that, so you just saw it from the... Which worked.
It would have been totally sweet. I'm just saying.
But that was a completely out of nowhere, like, all of a sudden there's 100 of them as opposed to 5 of them.
Exactly. And I think that put forward the severity.
And I think
that it, at first you're thinking, oh, it's. But in reality, there's hundreds.
No escape.
Yeah, they're everywhere. There's so many.
LA's full of them. I think that's the message. This town is full of these people. You never notice them, but you know what? You assholes made the mistake of getting mixed up with Jack Hanna in his safari suit. Now we're coming after your ass. So they start running. They go downstairs, and they're coming in through the kitchen. This house is just imploding under just leather-bound dudes smashing through the walls and windows. And finally, they go up in the attic. And this is another example, like when he was under the car and they trapped him. The ghouls get you, and then they go away.
I don't understand that.
They go up in the attic, and the
and
two
you know,
women
it's
are
funny
hiding
that
up
you
there.
Just said that right now.
Because
early on, when he goes out, the first time he goes out tracking down the guys in the van, they stop at a gas station. And just above the van, the graffiti on the wall, it says ghouls. And I noticed that.
I did not. Good catch.
I only call them ghouls because that's what George Romero referred to zombies as in the original draft.
When he's out there, they stop at a gas station.
Really?
And it literally, on behind them, it says ghouls.
They are ghouls.
So it.
Good catch. I didn't see
good
that.
Good catch by me.
Yeah. Yes.
It's not a contest.
No,
it's a good catch by Cody. I didn't notice that. There's so much graffiti in this movie.
And, it is LA.
And look, it is. I'll get to that in a minute. So they go up into the attic, the two women. These people are coming at them. All of a sudden, the Whitesnake video chick punches through the attic door, comes up, gives them this creepy smile, and you're like, all right, game over. They got through. Then she goes back down, and they all leave.
I don't understand that. I never
But never they did that throughout the whole
that.
Movie.
Yeah.
When he was taking pictures of the Whitesnake chick, he lived. Yeah. When...
And that's what I'm saying. That's why I equated them to gremlins.
They're teasing.
They're teasing.
Well, it goes back to Halloween.
They don't really cause... I mean, other than, yeah, you saw them, you know...
They don't.
Brosnan sees him, kills a guy, but he doesn't... Because when he goes back and looks into the thing, there's no body in that dumpster.
Yeah, but you brought up a comparison...
They're just being Loki.
Right.
Tuttle brought up a comparison to, like, Halloween and playing with shadows and all that. I mean, that's a huge characteristic of Halloween is, you know, Michael Myers teased... He could have killed all those girls within 10 minutes of the film if he wanted to. He laid traps to tease them. He would lead them in somewhere and then be behind them. He would lock doors where they weren't locked before just to mind games. I mean, that's half the terror of Halloween is that he's toying, you know, they're rats in a maze, and he's toying with them till he's ready to take them out. That's what we're talking about here, having fun with your victims. That's what these ghouls are. That's what these Inuits are. So they're in the attic. The chick comes up, full of face makeup and hairspray. She smiles and leaves. The girls wait until I guess the cover of darkness, go downstairs, still with their suitcases. I thought they'd just get the fuck out of there as fast as they could, but no, they still want their suitcases. And they get in the car and they head out. Now, the house was totaled.
Yeah, they destroyed the house.
These ghosts love graffiti.
They love graffiti,
man. Oh my
God,
they tagged the hell out of this house. And I tried, because I know you noticed ghouls earlier. I watched. I didn't like rewind, but I was trying to look on the walls like for some kind of message, or some kind of like. No, it's just like a bunch of just
straight up eighties
graffiti, like a skateboard ramp. I mean, it was.
Yeah,
they destroyed this house.
That's a good description.
They run out. They get in the whatever car that was, and then they are, and you know, just like I said, it shows them speeding away. And it shows them, like, you know, I mean...
Which, it was handled very tensely, them getting to the car
and
starting it up. You half expected
it was great.
You half expected Adam Ant to be in the back seat of the car.
Yeah.
Like, That was handled with some good execution as far as them. But then when they got out, I was surprised. Like, all right, well, they're out. And the next thing you know, they're driving in dawn's light on a highway. Very kind of the end of Blade Runner.
Yeah.
You know, where you see Decker and the replicant driving to freedom. And I almost thought that was the end of the movie. I was like, you know what? Maybe they got out away from that. They made such a point of the house being
the conduit
of all this evil. You know, maybe that's the end of this movie. Maybe they're just driving away, which I would have been okay with, but that's not where this movie ended. There's a twist.
Nice little ghost story twist.
Maybe a little M. Night Shyamalan twist.
Maybe he got it from this dude.
But they're driving down the highway, and all of a sudden, they think they're free, and they see a biker, leather-bound biker, zipping up fast behind them. And they're like, oh, shit.
Don't.
It's not over. The biker zips up next to him. He's got a helmet and these huge
road goggles,
road goggles. Goes in front of him. They're like, oh, God. And you're like, they were almost away in this guy. But then all of a sudden, he goes out in front of him, pulls over way ahead of him. It's a country highway. Pulls over on the side, and he's waiting there for him as they drive by. Again, in slow motion.
Kudos to the motorcycle stunt driver on that, because he did a nice little fishtail.
I'm laughing, but I really do like this ending. I really do. They drive by the biker who's pulled over on the side of the road. He takes off his helmet with his spiked wristbands, chainmail vest, just
the chains hanging off the shoulders.
God, I don't know who gave him this once he was...
But bless you.
It is Jean Charles. Pierce Brosnan is now one of...
It's not Jean Charles, you son of a bitch. It's Remington Steele. Shade.
No, he's not shady. He has his beard.
He has beard.
He has his beard.
Oh, I totally... Well, I'm...
I wanted to be Remington Steele. Remington Tut. Yeah,
but he had the classic pose, the...
Yeah. He had the dashing... I mean, it was a very cheesy look he gave the girls.
But it was...
It was a look that... It got across what the story wanted. I'm one of them now.
Is he?
Yes.
Yeah. You know that because they drive by, and he chooses... They go screen left. He pulls out, and I actually thought to myself, I hope he goes screen right. He's not going to follow him. He was just letting them know...
And then he goes back.
He's one of them now. He goes right past the entering California sign,
yeah.
And that's, I think, we're supposed to believe that California, more specifically L.A., is home to these ghosts, home to these wandering nomads. And he got sucked in too far to where he's one of them now, whether he likes it or not.
Yeah.
But he's not going to fuck with them anymore. They got out.
Yeah.
Like the nun said, it's not too late. You can't escape this, which they did. But he wanted to show them that the chase ends here. And then he goes back into California. I thought it was a great ending.
I liked it. I thought it was a classic ghost story.
You would have liked it better if you were clean shaven.
Yeah, pretty much. It was a classic ghost story ending. And I just dig ghost stories. I think it's pretty cool. And I thought this guy did a good job with it.
I don't like supernatural stuff at all.
Well, you know, and that's why I said, like, that last scene, that's why I said it gave more of that. After you see it and you go think about it back in retrospect, it's not so much like it's a scary story. It's like you see him succumbing to them, that seduction. He gives in because he searched the whole world. This is what he did. He looked for these people, these nomads, these tribes,
and they play into that a lot with his photography on the wall. Right.
And that's why I said you go back, even back to that very opening sequence of the credits. It just shows you
that singular nomad.
Well, I think that's kind of that picture is somehow like maybe he captured one of them.
Kind of Kubrickian Shining, where you end it with a Jack picture.
Well, that would be if you ended the movie and they showed that Eskimo picture and you zoomed in on that face and it was Brosnan's face inside the Eskimo face.
Well, you know, and they talked about spirits.
I think you're right, though.
One of the old Native American things was they didn't want to get their picture taken because it would steal their soul.
Yeah.
And I kind of took from that, or I said, you know, is he trying to say, like, he actually captured one of their souls? Because he got that picture of that one on the ice.
That's, you know what? I think that's a valid...
That's a good theory.
That's a valid theory. I think that and the combination of the Bertril, the nun, saying, they're here, they don't bother us because we don't look deep enough. They get away with shit because nobody gives them the attention that they want. You were the only asshole who got your camera and chased it.
Yeah.
I think that's one theory. I think it can work in conjunction with your theory of not only did he do that, but he also captured years and years of nomads on other continents. Like, this was just his destiny. This was going to happen as a result of
just him chasing
him, putting on those cargo pants and that jacket every day of his life.
Stay away from the cargo pants and the jacket.
Yeah. If he'd just worn something different. What else are you going to do wearing that?
Now he's wearing leathers.
It was a pretty sweet leather outfit he had, too. But it was a good ending.
It was.
And I was more... I have a huge problem with endings.
Yeah.
And this one, it was like... When you're watching it, and you're like, please... They set up something where you can root for an ending.
Yeah.
That one did good. So, that's the end of our movie. I liked it. You know, despite the pitfalls of you know, very time period centric wardrobe and music in certain point.
And also there were some novice decisions.
And novice decisions.
And budget decisions, because a lot of times, like we're founding out, like even with Carpenter with Escape from L.A., you are a slave to the budget at some point.
You are. But this reminded me a lot of Carpenter in that, you know, his first film, Assault on Precinct 13, you know, it had flashes of what was to come. I don't go back and watch Assault on Precinct 13 a lot, but I do love it, and I love one of the things I love about it is seeing that young filmmaker mind. You can almost see him wanting to do more that he can't do.
That's where. Go ahead.
And then you watch Halloween, or even a bigger budget like The Fog, is when you first see somebody give Carpenter money, and it's like, all right, fuckers, this is what I can do, and he does it, and it's like. To watch that maturation from Assault on Precinct 13 to Halloween to The Fog to even Escape from New York, even more money and better actors and everything. It's like, I love watching that trajectory of talent develop over time. And you see it with the great directors. You see it, you know, we're I don't know why we were talking about Boogie Nights earlier. Oh, and... Our new table tonight is a prototype. Well, not prototype. It's an early stage development of what eventually will be our new Tuesday Night Cigar Club table.
Our man Cody made this.
Check it out on YouTube. You'll see clips of it. But I sent a picture of it to our boy Mincy, and he responded like, "It's a real podcast, Jack," which is a quote from Boogie Nights. But look at Paul Thomas Anderson. His first movie, Heart Eight, not a good movie. You could tell he wanted to be a bigger something. Now, granted, I don't feel sorry for guys' first movie. You've got Gwyneth Paltrow and Samuel Jackson, and if only I had these obstacles to overcome. But you look at Boogie Nights, and then you look at the going to There Will Be Blood, and I love seeing filmmakers grow and keep the spirit of their early stuff, but just grow.
Yeah,
Carpenter grew. Paul Thomas Anderson has always kept growing. And I think McTiernan, like you said, what, this came out in 86. 2 years later, Predator's coming out.
Yeah, that's...
about a welcome to the big leagues.
Yeah. But see, that's one of the things that's kind of cool about it, is that I'm not sure if a casual... moviegoer will appreciate this movie as much, but as someone who does appreciate movies, you gotta love seeing those very early scenes that you can tie directly to Predator, directly to Die Hard.
Those zooms.
There was one in the house, and it wasn't during the attack of the house. It was an exchange between Pierce and his wife, to where it was a continuous shot that was like going left. Then it kind of went
down to the ground on the first floor, then to the right, then back to the left. It was just a very continuous shot that was straight out of Predator, or he incorporated that shot into Predator when things really get cooked up. I love being able to make those connections. And like you say, you're seeing a director's thoughts. You're seeing him grow
it. And that's one of the things I'll say, just, you know, looking at that, at his body of work, McTiernan loves stairs. He loves down angles.
Yes.
If you look at this, I mean, that staircase in that house, many scenes.
Die Hard was all about stairs.
Yeah.
I mean, but you look at Predator. Those guys are sliding down hills.
They
constantly.
Yeah, that's a good catch.
What people don't realize about Predator was, and if you watch the behind-the-scenes stuff, the biggest obstacle in that movie for camera gear, for effects, for the actors, there was no flat land. Everything, that jungle is completely an angle.
Yeah.
And I saw, Jenny and I went there. This would have been before, oh God, man, early 2000s. We went to Puerto Vallarta for vacation, and right outside where we stayed was where they filmed the Predator scene. And I still regret it, although I don't, because we could have taken a donkey ride to the they still have the helicopter out in the jungle there.
He calls it a donkey ride. Donkey show.
Donkey show.
Listen, we could have taken donkeys and ridden them out to... And they packed you a picnic lunch.
A natural level.
You could eat a picnic lunch out at the downed Jim Hopper's helicopter. But I took one look at that sickly little pony that was giving these rides.
They're pack animals. They can take a lot.
I told Jenny, I was like, I'm not going to kill that donkey. If I get in that saddle, it wasn't much of a saddle.
Actually make a groaning noise.
There's literally no way I'm getting to the chopper.
Oh no!
I will not get to the chopper on that donkey. But at the very least,
it would have been more of like a hee-haw.
If I tried, though, I guess, like, if my donkey went down, I could always, like, point to Jenny's donkey, like, get her to the chopper. But no, they were horrible, sickly, weak donkeys. And I was like, you know what? I don't care how good the picnic lunch is that they're going to give us up there. I can't do it. So I took a picture of me by the sign for the donkey Predator tour. But, dude, it's all, the land is all 45-degree angles. And when you watch the interviews with the actors, Tom, it's like, and you see them, like, the camera setups. They're like, everything is... That film had so many logistical... Not to mention, like, dealing with, you know, originally the Predator was Jean-Claude Van Damme in a red foam suit dancing around the thing. Like, how he pulled out a masterpiece. My favorite film of all time. How this second-time filmmaker could pull that together out of all the obstacles. Which, the only thing he had under his belt was...
This.
Nomads? That's a fucking ballsy, talented motherfucker right there.
He stepped up to the challenge.
And then you're going to go into... Oh, what can I possibly follow this up with? I don't know, Die Hard?
Dun, 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 dun.
Well, I mean... Dun, 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 and that just... And I think... Like I said, his style really... is what made those movies. You see it in Nomads. You see it with the camera work. And in Nomads, and like I said, it really was just sort of... It was what he wrote. He knew what he wanted to see through that lens.
I almost think Nomads would have been better if he hadn't written it. A lot of it appeared too close to his chest. He's trying to preserve stuff that probably would have...
True.
As a director, you would have made things more efficient and more... You would have left a lot more...
But once again,
you would have explained a lot more efficiently.
You see
and
those other films, and you see that he gave four, you know, I mean, literally, after Predator, Die Hard, he eventually got a budget. He got people that could fill in and give him the effects, give him the choreography for his fights.
I'm not a big fan of Hunt for Red October, but...
Oh, Love that film.
Filmmaking. It's nothing from his point of view.
The stuff on the screen, because I mean the effects, I mean that was a huge step up for effects for submarine. Because I mean, you know, you look at it and people go, "Oh, well, you know, it looks so masterful." None of it was in water.
Yeah.
It was models in smoke.
Yeah.
But you had this amazing thing like, this is underwater.
I did not know that.
Yes. And
awesome.
He also, it's a rare thing when you have the technical, you know, skills that he had as far as, you know, working with the DP and doing in-camera zoom work and slow-mo and all these kind of technical things and getting DPs to respect you because you understand the camera and understand how to do those things. But he has that rare thing where, obviously, working with actors where they like working with him. I mean, very few have repeat customers. I mean, he worked with Arnold on Predator. Arnold insisted he come back for Last Action Hero. Bruce Willis insisted he come back for Die Hard 3. Like, these guys like working with this guy because they know, one, he's going to make them look good.
Yeah.
But he knows how to tell a story.
And I think that's what you get with this.
I think it's a
film.
Damn shame that the guy hasn't made a movie since 2003. He's not an old guy.
Wow.
I'm going to get into a minute on why he's
wow.
been out of the picture for so long, because I think it's worth a brief discussion.
Really? Because, I mean, yeah, he had a run there.
His last film was in 2003, I believe. It was the John Travolta film, Basic. I think it was a military.
Yeah.
Admittedly, I've not seen it.
Was he like the investigator or what? Yeah, I remember seeing that. Yeah.
I think before that, it was the Rollerball remake with the guy from American Pie, Chris Klein, and LL Cool J, and Rebecca Romijn Stamos. I have not seen that either. I love the original Rollerball with James Caan.
Yeah,
I'm a huge fan, but I probably should see it. I know McTiernan was unsatisfied with it.
Yeah.
I think he may have almost tried to take his name off it. So mix in that cast with him unhappy, it's not a good incentive.
Not a good sign. Yeah.
But in 2006, McTiernan got a phone call one night from the FBI late at night asking about his involvement with a Los Angeles private investigator, Anthony Pellicchio or Pellicano. This was a huge story for years in Hollywood. This guy was a private investigator who's a notorious wiretapper. You could pay him enough money, he would wiretap whoever you wanted to. Steven Seagal was involved with him. A bunch of Hollywood people were paying this guy to tap phones, and allegedly McTiernan had hired this guy to investigate a producer that he was working with on a film. Later would become on as one of his ex-wives accused him of wiretapping, hiring this guy to wiretap one of her phone lines.
Yeah.
McTiernan's been married like 4 times. Creative types, what are you going to do? But the FBI called in the middle of the night.
Don't listen to that,
started asking him questions. How many times have you worked with this Anthony guy? He answered. Turns out the answer he gave them over the phone, which shouldn't have even been occurred. The FBI can't call you on the phone. They have to, by their guidelines, present you a ID and have your lawyer present. He got charged with falsifying statements, lying to the FBI. It was a one count of perjury or whatever. Once he realized with his lawyer that he shouldn't have done this, he tried to appeal to get his because he had pled guilty on the spot. Get that revoked. It went back and forth in the courts. During that time, kept getting knocked around the courts, really kind of unjustly and unfairly. He made a YouTube video. It's called the political. I'm trying to remember what the name was. It was about biased prosecutions against people for over the years, a history of politically motivated prosecutions against certain people.
Yeah.
He put it up on YouTube, and this is during his appeal process. And soon after that came out, the charges against him were quadrupled. And
don't fuck with City Hall.
There's no evidence that he hired this guy to wiretap anybody, but he pissed off a lot of people. The judge said you're just someone who's lived in the life of luxury and wants to avoid getting that taken away from you. Denied him appeal. He took it all the way to the Supreme Court. Started in 2006. They basically, through this huge shitstorm, appeal after appeal was rejected. He made the YouTube video about, you know, detailing the prosecutorial misconduct. And next thing you know, boom, 2013, he checks into federal prison for a year-long sentence. And he was released in February, 10 months later, 2014. He was released from prison. Apparently his wife was started a Facebook page. Samuel L. Jackson, a lot of people worked with him, were very adamant about voicing support to get John out of there. Apparently he did not handle incarceration well. Who would? Especially when there was no hard evidence against him. He was pretty much railroaded from all accounts. This is one of those things that we, as a rule, kind of tend to steer clear of in Tuesday Cigar Club. Too much political stuff. But it basically took a filmmaker at his prime out of commission in his prime years. Now the guy's in his 60s. He's been out of prison since last year. I had heard rumors that he was approached after Mel Gibson declined to direct Expendables 3. They went to McTiernan, but he was literally fresh out of prison. If what I hear is true, that they want to do Expendables 4 with a sci-fi twist, Stallone has been chasing his Predator movie since Predator came out. He bought rights to a book called Hunter, which I have.
Stallone or Schwarzenegger?
Stallone. Stallone was always very jealous that Schwarzenegger got Predator. Yeah. He thought it was, like he should.
That's kind of funny, because Predator originally was supposed to be called Hunter.
That was the original shooting script. Yeah. There's a book called Hunter, and it's about a very Dutch-like mercenary kind of group of commandos that get sent down into Mexico, I believe. There's a creature down there killing people. And Stallone bought the rights to the book, and he wanted to do it. That was going to be a Rambo sequel, where Rambo gets pulled down into Mexico to fight this kind of...
No, that would have been a twist.
Chupacabra type of monster.
That would have been for Rambo awesome. In and of itself, that would have been horrible.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, the last Rambo movie
horribly
was
awesome.
Just, well, yes. No, no.
Rambo ended on the perfect
note. Oh, God. But we're not going to go down that road. It's another hour discussion right
That's
there.
What Tuesday nights are.
But
20 Stallone, gigs of video.
Stallone owns the rights to this Hunter story. And I'd heard where he was thinking about adapting that into Expendables thing. Kind of this sci-fi slant where they get called in to go down
and deal with this
beast.
Yeah.
And my wish, I haven't heard this anymore, but my idea was, if you're going to do an Expendables 4, that's kind of where you have to go, with somewhere crazy with it. Who's better than John McTiernan? Give him the Expendables crew, which he's shown with Predator.
He can do beautifully.
Put him in the Mexican, you know, middle Mexico, in a weird environment, which he can do beautifully. And give him that sci-fi element. Let's bring him back, man. That is like the juiciest welcome home gift you could give to John McTiernan.
Just pisses me off that the dude did a year in Fed for perjury.
Which was never proven. Yeah. Which was actually, according to the guidelines of the FBI, not even... If he hadn't made that YouTube video, it was called, I think it was called the Political Persecution of Karl Rove. And it was all about just the trend of politically motivated prosecutions in court of political figures.
So he was like siding with Rove?
No, he was not siding with Rove. The title was misleading.
Oh, okay.
But it was based on, you know, politically motivated prosecutions.
Because I could see a Hollywood going ape over something like that.
No,
kind of like Milius with his conservative slant, you know. Everybody goes on him.
I think Matiernan's kind of like Milius, much more libertarian.
Yeah.
Not. It was not a pro Roe Bush agenda. If anything, that probably would have got him out of jail at that point.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's a sad story, and he still has yet to do anything.
Yeah, see, I didn't know that. That sucks.
For a guy that talented who's done those kind of movies, we talked about Predator, we talked about Die Hard, Hunt for Red October, 13th Warrior, which you guys like. I don't remember a lot about Medicine Man.
I liked it.
It was decent. The storyline the plot that they were trying to go with was interesting.
Yeah.
It was very difficult on like some of it to. You just really didn't feel it from Connery being in the jungle.
Why? I'm
was it the pony? Was it the ponytail?
It was the ponytail. It was the ponytail.
Yeah.
I mean, it's. And don't get me wrong. I mean.
It was a nice flex for him to say, I'm more than just action movies. That's what it was.
But wasn't it an action movie?
No,
not really.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was a drama.
Oh. Okay. Well, I don't remember anything about medicine.
I'm down here in the rainforest studying herbs and plants, trying to save from the people who are deforestation.
So it was an Austin action movie.
Kind of, sort of, yeah. Yeah.
Just down here at the farmer's market, down at the co-op.
Except with a lot less of Instagram filters. You know, he didn't go with that. Didn't go full hipster on him.
Okay.
Sean Connery with some Migas.
Well, I mean,
damn your Migas.
They're tasty. I can't help it.
What can do with this guy?
Not give him any Migas.
No, serve me Migas and I'll shut up.
No Migas for you.
Maddie, do you like Migas?
Thank you, man. Good answer.
She does.
Don't give him the satisfaction.
She does.
So I just kind of want to touch on that. I don't know all the facts of the case. I just know that, you know, he's a great filmmaker, and the fact that he's even been out of prison over a year now and hasn't made another film, I think he's in his early 60s.
Well, that's gotta fuck with your head.
Oh, apparently he did not take it well. He did not.
Who would?
Wesley Snipes seemed to bounce back pretty okay.
I don't think so. I saw his lines.
Yeah, he'd aged. So okay, well that's Nomads. As far as the beer goes, each pint that comes, I'm appreciating it more, because usually with the lagers, whether it's the kind of the back end sweetness or just kind of the heaviness, I'm not getting any of that. It's maintained that crispness. I keep going back to the word crispness. It's got that crispness on the drink, and that's good stuff.
It's a very crisp, nice, fresh beer, and it's maintained that way through, you know, countless pints.
Best thing that I like, and the problem is with what a lot of people have taken from current lagers because of the big brewers, is most people expect their Budweiser or their to be ice cold. That beer's not supposed to be served ice cold. You can't taste anything ice cold.
Sorry, Coors.
I mean, and that's we
You're
don't
talking about the guys digging through the ice.
Yes, you can't taste anything ice cold. The human body just does not. I mean, you can serve up any beer ice cold, and people will talk about all these flavors. Most of them, like, what are you talking about? You're tasting nothing almost.
Yak boy. I'm going to take you back to the year 1993.
1993?
Two young men who knew that beer was not meant to be ice cold gathered their shovels and supplies, drove out to Lake Belton here in Central Texas.
Didn't we have some sort of
vest?
Were we wearing
the anthropological vest?
I mean,
We needed some.
You're gearing up like Commando.
True story, listeners. One day after school, juniors or seniors?
I think we were juniors.
Maybe juniors.
Because we were not yet privy to being able to...
No, we couldn't acquire our own beer. There had been a party out at this Lake Belton, and when the popo, the police, had shown up, several people had buried their beer in underneath rock, or hidden it underneath rocks at the lake. And we overheard this information in class that day. And me and Cody got together and conspired. We're like, hey, I heard some seniors talking about they buried some old Milwaukees out of Lake
Belton.
Oh my
God, this is like the plot from Stand By Me.
It could have been.
Substitute dead body to old Milwaukee.
Well, so we're like, did you hear it? You're like, yeah, they buried it under some big rocks out at Cedar Ridge. So Cody and I skip out of our last period of class.
Don our fedoras
and our satchels and our Jean Charles cargo pants and vests. We drive, that's good, what, 35, 40 minutes?
Well, we get out there, but then we have to slowly circle. We look for large rocks.
We've got the staff, the Raiders of the Lost Ark staff with the sun shining through the emblem. And we start digging. It was almost dusk. The sun was coming down when we finally...
Did you hit pay dirt?
We overturned this huge rock.
You remember that scene in like Raiders of the Lost Ark? When they find the temple and Saul is over there with the big pry bar, he's all... That was us. We find this rock and we're just like...
It totally was.
And we push this rock out of the way and underneath it, sure enough... It's like a case of beer.
It's like a hefty bag.
Yeah.
It's in a hefty bag. It was the Die Hard music. Da, 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 da. And we look at each other and we're like, jackpot. And we pull it out. It's all covered in mud and shit and dirt. We pick it up, scrape off the top. Yeah, it's been down in cold soil, but like this goes with the story. Not cold beer. This has been perfectly... Nature has kept this at its proper... Whatever old Milwaukee... It wasn't old Milwaukee, was it?
I can't remember what it was, but it was delicious.
It may have been Bush. I think it was Bush.
Bush.
It was Bush.
It was delicious because you worked your asses off for it.
Yeah. Other kids were chasing other Bush. We were out the lake excavating... lands for
our like, our yeah. love
that's why we have a cigar beer
grain podcast. Knew no bounds.
We said I remember dude, this is how sad it is. I remember you and I looking at each other just like we were so fucking happy. And we weren't happy about a lot back then. I mean we weren't ecstatic teenagers.
No,
but we were pretty disgruntled.
We were even so happy.
At an early age, we were pretty nihilistic, disgruntled teenagers. But man, we looked at each other. Our smiles were so fucking big. We're covered in dirt and bird shit, and ducks were like flying or like shitting on us. But dude, we looked at each other. I remember it. I can close my eyes and remember it beautifully. We both wiped off the top of the first bush can. We looked at each other and we're like.
Drank that sucker down.
I think we stayed out there for like 5 or 6 hours. We got pretty shit faced out there.
sad to say, we go out there. We still had beer with us.
That's the thing. We had beer going. We drank the whole way out there,
and we still. And we, then we get out there, and we're like,
but it wasn't found beer. It wasn't found beer. This is like beer from your fridge in your garage.
Beer from the earth.
That was easy beer.
The earth.
Oh.
Yielded up this harvest of beer.
And the beer from your house was cold, and we knew beer isn't meant to be cold. No. We've got to go do this like Jean Charles will do it.
Jean Charles? Out on Lake Belton.
That was a great day. That was a really great day.
We were so happy.
Yeah. And I remember like we took the hefty bag full of dirty swamp beers back with us.
swamp beer.
Because like that Friday was a football game, and I remember we were. I think we had like Jenny and like some other girls like getting the truck. Like, hey girls,
want some swamp beer?
We're in the back. We got some lake beers. And like, what is that?
What's the smell?
Did a cow shit in here? Kate smoking his cigars again. No, baby, that's liquid gold.
We were so happy.
Yeah, so happy.
The halcyon days.
The halcyon days. Those were the halcyon days. So that's a little story for the listeners. There'll be more of those as time goes on. I'm surprised Mincy hasn't. Mincy's got a lot of good stories. He's a good storyteller. But that was a good one. Maybe we'll treat you to another one down the line. The Nomad Connecticut Fuerte cigar for me was a winner. I don't know if the promise of, you know, something to completely blow away all their Connecticuts was reached, but to a guy that doesn't really smoke a lot of Connecticuts, I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
I thought what was unique about it was the smoke production, and it was very bold. It was very...
I think that's accurate. I think it was a very nice... the construction was hands down really well. It did have a little bit more flavor than I'm used to packing from a Connecticut. Cody, you are a Connecticut smoker. Chime in.
That one was there. I don't know if... You know, like it was said earlier... I mean, just the smoke coming off of it. I mean, it was well constructed, and I don't know if maybe that batch of tobacco, whatever they put in for it, if that it just burned well.
Yeah, kudos to the
roller. It stayed, and that was. I only had to relight once. I mean, we talked a lot.
Yeah,
but
I don't think I ever relit it.
It.
Wow.
It had a good flavor.
Okay, and so like
I don't know if
I
that was
a,
from that tobacco being able to.
If you're at a cigar bar in Houston, you go to visit friends or whatever, and you're drinking some bourbon or whatever. If you go into a humidor and you're looking around, you see that Nomad, are you gonna go for it and be like,
oh yeah,
I know I'm gonna have a great experience.
Definitely.
All right.
I was approached with this the other day. We were at a Heroes and Legacies there in Austin, a little cigar deal.
I saw that. Thank you for the invite.
And you're welcome. We wanted to keep it classy. That's why you weren't invited.
Oh, understood.
So, but I got hit with the question. A friend of ours that doesn't smoke a lot, but smokes some, and he was like, he was on the phone, and he was like, yeah, pick me out a couple of medium-bodied cigars. I don't want anything too full. Medium's not really. I usually go from medium to full. So I always hate it when people are like, yeah, pick me out something. You do a cigar cast or a cigar podcast. You know what you're talking about. I know what I'm talking about with my flavor profile. I don't know what anybody else's is. So when he was like, medium body, would you tag him with this?
Yes.
I think so.
I'll say this. Our composer, songwriter, musician extraordinaire,
Fritz
Beer.
What's the URL?
www.fritzbeermusic.com.
If you like the music on the podcast, you ought to check it out.
He does our theme song. Yes. He does our end credits. He, like me, was a cigarette smoker, but after listening to a couple shows, he was like, "God damn, you guys won't make me want to, you know, smoke a cigar or whatever." And I was like, "You know what? If you're serious about it, I'll put together a little care package for you of just, you know, 5 cigars, nothing." Because what he said was he wants to, next time he comes down to Texas, he wants to be a guest star on the TNCC. He's like, I don't want to get green and puke in front of you guys, so I want to have, you know, I want to be kind of broken in. I was like, you know what, I'm going to put together a little care package for you. This is a cigar that I would definitely put, actually we have one left, I will put this in a care package with him. Not as the most, if I'm doing a spectrum of mild to medium, this won't be the most mild thing,
yeah,
I'll give him.
It's got a little bit of flavor too.
But no way is he going to light this sucker up and be frightened off or be overwhelmed.
Yeah.
This is a really good, mild, halfway between mild and medium bodied, but a lot of personality for Connecticut.
That personality, that is a very good keyword, because I've had friends to where I've given like a Liga Privada 9
and I should have just given them a Black and Mild. It's not a knock on them. They just didn't have experience with cigars.
I mean,
so they don't really know what they're tasting. They don't really know what to look for. It's something that you would give to somebody that if once you know what you're looking for, you can taste it right off.
Yeah,
you can
spot. I mean, that's a good point. And not to pick on your friends, because a lot of them have become friends of ours over the years. But at your wedding, you handed out your favorite cigar that you had bought when you got engaged, Liga Privada number 9s. They'd been about a year aged. A lot of those guys aren't cigar smokers. They're not going to, which I think we kind of realized as everybody was smoking it, they're not going to really appreciate what they're smoking. I'm not saying you should have, you know, given them Philly blunts.
But it's such an advanced
mature cigar that if you're not a cigar smoker, you're not going to realize how good what you're smoking is.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why I want to, someone like Fritz, I want to give him a kind of a starter kit. Start here. Once, you know, this is what you should get out of this. Then go up to this. You're going to get a little bit more. This is what you can get out of this. If you like this, go to this. If it's a little too much, kick it down to this. It's like like beer. I mean, it's exactly like beers. Like you say all the time when people walk in and like, I want an IPA, but I don't want this.
Like, absolutely. It's like me with wine. If you hand me like a 1776 bottle of wine, I'm not going to be able to discern all the complexity to it because I'm not that big of a wine drinker. Whereas someone like Mincy would be like, oh, I understand this. This has a ton of complexity to it.
Mad Dog 2020.
Oh my God, we were actually talking about
that.
You got
me fooled.
No, we were actually talking about that at Heroes and Legacies. A guy brings out a scotch. It was like Cal Il. It was C-A-O-L space I-L. And it was a beautiful, wonderful.
Isn't that Superman's dad?
No, that's Cal Il.
That's Superman. Jor-El is Superman.
It was a beautiful, complex but smooth scotch. But we were talking about, you know, how when we were younger, we were dissatisfied with Mad Dog.
Banana red, baby, banana red, or kiwi lime.
It was gross. Grape.
Grape Mad. Oh, I'm gonna have a hangover just thinking of it.
That's right.
There was a guy, real quick, on Cats, the Facebook group that we're a part of. Join it.
Seek them up. Facebook. Cats.
C period A period T period S. Cigar Aficionado Trades and Sales. It's a wonderful, welcoming, one of the more friendly Facebook groups. They'll help you whether you're a beginner or more experienced. But there was a guy on there the other day who brought up Mad Dog. He said he was in the service with a guy who had a tattoo on his arm of a range of dates. It was like, you know, April something to May something, like tattooed on his arm, and he asked him what it was. That was the day that he drank Mad Dog until he went into a coma, and that's the day he woke up from his Mad Dog coma.
Oh my God.
So he looks at that tattoo, he doesn't drink anymore. But that's the week long period that he was in a coma due to Mad Dog. And I flashed back to all those years in college hunched over Mincy's wastebasket in his parents' house over the puking up Mad Dog, and I'm like, eh, it could have been me. I wouldn't get a tattoo.
Well, if it reminds you not to do it again,
I get a brand. I'm a real man.
When was the last time you wanted to get one of those?
I drank one this morning. No, I'll be honest. Haven't had it in.
That's why.
Yeah. That's antifreeze. That's horrible stuff. One day we will pair. We'll find a pairing for Mad Dog on the show. But no, I agree. You know what? The Connecticut Fuerte, the Nomad, was a really cool Connecticut. Really change of pace. I'm glad we did it. It really paired well with the crisp, you know, no aftertaste, no nonsense lager. Man, I
have to say I'm really I'm kind of taken back by both the House of Emilio and their cigars and Carbach Brewing.
Carbach's on a roll.
They are, and I said this before a previous podcast, they're very young. They're maybe about 4 years old now, but they're pushing ahead like crazy.
Is that it? 4 years?
Yeah. That's crazy. But they have been out there, and they're fighting tooth and nail. They want to grow.
Are they one of the few
to experience their beer?
Let me ask you this: are they one of the few that I know they do a lot of cans?
Well, canning, you know, that's kind of been one of the sore subject in craft beers for a long time. People said, "Oh, you can't taste good beer unless it comes out of glass or out
of a
keg."
Which is bullshit.
Well, if you're sitting there saying, "Oh, only draft beer is good," well, I can even go and say some beers on draft taste fantastic. But when you get down to it, a can is just a really small keg. And canning has gotten much better. People say, I can taste it, but the linings that they put inside of those cans now is so good that they do not impart any flavors into that beer.
Yeah, it's not like Mad Men where you're taking the motor oil can opener.
Did Keystone start all that with the bottle beer taste in the can?
I don't know if that was them originally.
I'm sorry, I like Keystone.
You're just looking for anything to legitimize your love of Keystone.
Me and my roommate in college, we drank Keystone ad nauseum. It's a good beer. $3.99 for a sixer?
I don't know. You
can't beat that.
No. Keystone is its own.
It's kind of like Taco Bell.
Its own animal. Let's
put it like Keystone.
I believe that.
Is it its own entity or is it made by a major now?
Keystone, yes, it's made by a major. I think Budweiser, but don't quote me on that.
All right.
I'm not.
I'm okay with it.
Keystone's not in my wheelhouse.
Snob.
That's a nice way to put it.
You mega snob.
Cody, I've got some migas for you.
Let me ask you this, though. The Carbox, because on their website, they really showcase the cans. Are they available in bottles, or is it like... I know when we did the Buried Hatchet Stout, that was only available in cans.
Yeah, I've seen...
Is it draft or cans, or do they do bottles also?
A lot of them are primarily switching over to cans as their main...
I totally forgot that Carbach did the Buried Hatchet Stout.
Did they? No, they didn't.
Yeah, that's what...
I was just bringing it up because the Buried Hatchet was only available...
A lot of them have begun to switch over.
Yeah, I was
cans,
about to say...
Which, by the way, I bought a 4-pack and gave you, and that disappeared into thin air.
Cans are actually a better medium for beer. No light transfer. Light is the enemy of beer.
Okay.
Not so much air, light.
Light's very similar to cigars.
If you get a skunky beer in a bottle, blame it on light. Temperature, not so much.
That's an eerie parallel to cigars. A lot of people will tell you if a humidor is in direct contact with sunlight through like a glass door humidor or whatever, I mean that's a detriment to it.
Speaking of, after the podcast, I've got a humidor question for you. I got a humidor that's raging at 80% humidity, and I cannot get this thing down.
Keep those cigars away from my cigars.
Yeah.
You're quarantined.
Yeah, they should be.
Are you using Bovita packs?
No, I was using Zyker tubes.
Bovita packs.
Okay. Yeah, I picked a couple up at Tobacco Junction.
Get you some 68. You're talking about your big humidor?
No, I'm actually talking about the starter humidor I had from Thompson, I think it was.
Well, still, open door humidor that opens up and closes.
Yeah.
Always go 2% lower than what you want it. So if you want to keep it at 70, go 68% humidity packs.
Yeah. Well, I picked some up today, and
I'm sorry.
I plan on tossing it in there.
That.
So
if you want to keep it at 68, go 70% Bovita packs.
Okay.
Because with the open door, nothing is perfectly sealed. It'll keep it down. But the Bovita packs are magic. So.
Okay, well, I'll toss it. I bought a couple of 68s today, so I'll toss it in there and pour it back next week.
Yeah, anything above 72, you got to start worrying a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, because it's running hot, man.
Sketchy.
Yeah, which is weird because my other one, the nice old wood one, it's running nice at 70.
Yeah. One day we're gonna do a thing on the website too about our humidors at home, what we got in them, and be fun. But to sum it up, great beer, really good beer.
Yes,
we've been lucky. I mean, you know, not to cast stones, but
we haven't been lucky. We've had their tap.
O'Brien's
knows what they're doing.
Good guys. Again, the one week where we were kind of left wanting, the spinning mule, was a porter.
I think so. Yeah,
and Drew Estate porter. I didn't know whether that was the cigar influencing the beer or the beer influencing the cigar. It was kind of it came across as a boring cigar and a boring beer, but pair it with a different cigar, pair it with a different beer, who knows?
It really could
be
the pairing.
It's kind of a fun thing. I will say this. This afternoon, because I haven't smoked a lot of Connecticuts lately, I smoked a Oliva Nub Connecticut just to kind of get in the spirit of Connecticut smoking and give the Nomad a comparison point.
Right.
Oh, man. I mean, because Oliva's a brand I trust. The Nomad, complexity, flavor, everything just...
goes toe-to-toe? Better?
Exceeds it.
Ah, pushed it around the humidor.
Yeah.
All right, good.
Showed its balls and shoved that nub in the corner. It's like, you know what? This is what a Connecticut can be. Groovy. What you got? What you got?
Bring it.
Conserve.
Smoke.
Anything else, boys, before I get into closing shout-outs?
Let's drop the shout-outs.
All right.
Get on out of here.
I think it was a good night. I think it was a good movie.
It was a fantastic night.
We got chastised by a subscriber on iTunes today for being a little bit slow getting the last episode out. That's my fault. It was Easter weekend, and things happen, but it should be out there soon. If you subscribe on our website, TuesdayNightCigarClub.com, you'll be notified as soon as new posts and new podcasts go up. Subscribe on iTunes would be wonderful. Review us, even if it's just clicking, you know, 5 stars if you really like us. Or it's weird the way they work. If you don't like it, click 5 stars too. It's just it's the way they work.
Yeah.
No matter what you do, click 5 stars.
It was a weird algorithm that I, you know, when I stumbled across it, I didn't believe it. But yeah, if you really hate it, click the 5 stars.
Click 5 stars, yeah. And it will recognize your hipster irony and that you really meant 1 star. And it will send you a free thing of Migas in the mail. Also go to Facebook, TuesdayNightCigarClub.com. Like us. It will behoove you in the future. We're going to be doing some fun stuff. Twitter, TNCCCast. Or TNCCCast.
Yeah.
3 C's. Follow us on there. Instagram, TNCC_podcast. We post some good stuff on there. As we said earlier, go to fritzbeermusic.com.
Fritzbeermusic.com.
Also. My little girl, my little daughter, is always singing the little opening song. Bring another round. She loves it.
I'm singing the closing song. I get up, go to work, go to sleep.
She hears
everybody
because...
everybody loves monotony.
While I'm editing, while I'm going through the opening, working on the video clip, all she hears over and over again is, bring another round. She walks around singing. She loves it. She might be developing juvenile alcoholism.
Nice.
I guess I don't have to bring her another round every time she sings that.
No.
It's so cute. I can't help myself. But he is our musical counterpart.
Our siren, if you will.
Our musical siren and our biggest fan, and we're biggest fans of him. So,
also, shout out to Keith Howe. You'll hear his wonderful voice in a couple of seconds.
Keith Howe, our voiceover artist out of Chico, California. KeithAHowe.com. And O'Brien's. O'Brien'sTemple.com. They have a link on there to their tap list, which is always updated with current beers on tap.
Grab the app.
And current events coming down. Any big names coming down the pipeline? Wanna
We have an up-and-coming for Texas Country, a gentleman by the name of Josh Grider.
Josh Grider.
He'll be here on the 25th of April.
Okay.
And fantastic.
He's good stuff.
Yes.
We like Josh Grider.
Big songwriter.
Big songwriter. Okay. So get your ass to O'Brien's. You can smoke a cigar and listen to music. It's one of the few places.
One of the few places.
One of the few goddamn places you can smoke a cigar, listen to live music, and if you're not sure what beer you want, they will guide you in the right direction. God bless America.
America. Love it.
America. We still got it, baby. We still got it. Thank you, brothers, for joining
us. Land of the free.
It's a good night. Land of the free. May the wings of liberty never lose a feather. Have a good night. We'll see you next time.
For more on O'Brien's Irish Pub, the live music leader in Central Texas, please visit O'BriensTemple.com and download their free smartphone app, where you'll find full beer listings including over 40 on tap, menu information, and a calendar of upcoming events. To learn more about the time I spent an entire weekend naked on the Whitesnake tour bus, dang it, here I go again. To learn more about the cigars and libations enjoyed on tonight's episode, you can visit www.nomadcigarcompany.com and www.carbockbrewing.com. To listen and purchase music heard on tonight's program, check out www.fritzbeermusic.com. Thank you for listening to the Tuesday Night Cigar Club podcast. This is Keith A. Howell saying until next time, friends, unless we see you sooner at the pub. So keep it smoky, and for God's sake, keep it ballsy as well.